You ready?
Yes, we are, Mayor.
Okay. Got my little buttons. Where's my, oh, I'm not ready. I need my packet up. Come on. You can do it, little computer. Okay, so let's go ahead and call the July 9th meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order. And as always, we begin with the flag salute, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America,
and to the Republic for which it stands,
one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, Gina.
Mayor Pruitt?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Bond?
Here.
Councilmember Steckler?
Here.
Member Vignell?
Here.
Hey, John, if you ever can't hear us or something, let us know, and I will call on you during discussions. If you have nothing to say, that's fine, but I want to make sure you get to participate.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, so first up is audience communication, and Will Nelson has signed up.
So nice to be here again. Will Nelson, 14925 29th Drive Southeast, Mill Creek. Rectangular rapid flashing beacon replacement projects and bike lanes, favorite topics of mine. About all I can say about rectangular rapid flashing beacon replacement projects is that it looks to me like we're taking an awful lot of equipment that we spent a lot of money on and trashing it, equipment that we knew was solar powered and had some deficiencies in that regard in the less sunny days, and spending a whole lot of money for replacements. Personally, I think it's atrocious. We have gotten along for 20 years without these things. Then we had to put them in, and we put in solar. And now somebody's decided that we don't like that, so we're going to replace them. So we got a grant. I seriously doubt you guys will kill the project, but that's the way it goes. To me, this is much like the Hawk Light up on 132nd. I listened to the tape on the Hawk Light, and I was astounded at the almost total lack of responsibility on the part of all parties involved, meaning the young lady that got hurt, very unfortunate. But I didn't hear one word from any of those people on that tape that they were responsible, except for maybe at the end where the grandfather spoke. Yet somehow Mill Creek, in their minds, is responsible for putting in the Hawk Light. I went up there and drove that road. And from the closest light west of 35th to the next light on 35th east, that's 0.8 miles. If we put in the Hawk Light, that is, or some equivalent thing, that is 4 pedestrian control lights in 0.8 miles. And driving through there, I noticed on the left side would be the northeast corner of 35th and 132nd. There's a new residential subdivision. As you drive through that down the road, you can make a case that when the farm is put in, somebody can come and ask for another Hawk Light. So that could be 5 pedestrian control devices in 0.8 miles on a state highway. That, to me, sounds totally ridiculous. 5 pedestrian control lights in 0.8 miles on a state highway. And from a personal opinion, you know, people do all kinds of dumb things all the time that get themselves removed from the gene pool. I know that sounds harsh, sounds illogical, but we all do it from time to time. I ran a red light about 4 years ago up by the Taco Bell on 164th. If anything would have happened, it would have been on me, not anybody else, except for the poor person that got whacked. Other potential projects, Village Green Drive bike lane signs and painted bike lane markings. We've been through this twice before. And both times before, it seemed to be the consensus of the council that since we don't have sidewalks in all areas of the city, and especially those areas between the high school and Albertsons, a lot of that is gravel, or some of it is, that we weren't going to do painted bike lanes on Village Green Drive. I guess the new crowd doesn't realize that we've been there before on this. And personally, I agree with that. I do not think we should be spending money on painted on bike lanes for a few when we have so many kids walking to school where there's no sidewalks. I don't think it's logical. I don't think we should be putting in painted bike lanes on Village Green Drive. Nor do I think we should be putting in more signs. I think every city engineer has to take a course in college. It's called Signs 101. First paragraph, first chapter in Science 101 is, for every solution there is a problem, and that is to put up a sign. And I said that exactly the way I wanted to say it. Don't need any more signs on Village Green Drive. That's a nice scenic drive. That's one of the reasons I moved here. It's a nice scenic drive. And yet we get city engineers from Grantham on, I got to put up signs. Why do we need more signs? I think you got a new sign on Village Green Drive, and somebody's already taken a black spray can to it and defaced it. So, that's what I got to say.
Thank you, Will.
I hope you don't put up any more signs.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk to the council right now? Going once, twice? Okay, with that, we will move on to our first presentation. Oh, my gosh, rectangular rapid flashing beacons. City Manager?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. Mr. Matthew Feely, from a supervising engineer from our DPW department, is going to present. One of the discussions that Ms. Hortolosa and I have had is giving the opportunity of team members to come and present before council as well, particularly when it's their work and the council can get a look at the staff and be able to ask questions. It's my understanding that the solar power devices are just notoriously unreliable, expensive to repair, and it may have outlived their useful life. But I know that Mr. Feely is going to be giving us the presentation in its entirety. Thank you, Mayor.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Would it be possible to get a hard copy of this presentation? It won't load on my iPad. It's the only thing on the agenda that will not. I've rebooted it twice.
Yes. Actually, right now. I got it.
He's got the stuff on the left, but not on the right.
I have the same problem here. All I got is the agenda page. Mm-hmm.
Any ideas, James?
Try the website, John.
Does anybody else need a copy?
I have it.
Mine's working.
Can we take just a minute and get a copy?
Thanks so much.
Is that the only one that's not loading?
Yeah, the rest of it is. For me, anyway.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Good evening, everyone. My name is Matthew Feely. I'm the supervising engineer of the City of Mill Creek Public Works Department. Tonight's presentation is going to be on the rectangular rapid flashing beacon replacement project. From this point on, I'll refer to them as RRFBs. This presentation is for information only and requires no action from the City Council. So the presentation agenda, I'm going to cover the project background, our scope of the project, a project funding source, which in this case will be the TIB Complete Streets grant that we received. I'm going to discuss some other potential projects that could be funded in the case that there is leftover funding after the replacement project is complete, and then review the next steps for this RRFB replacement project. So a little bit about the project background, what I was able to gather from our maintenance staff, and just background in general. Rectangular rapid flashing beacons were invented and patented back in around 2008. The city has two particular locations where these beacons were installed. That was around the year 2010. The purpose of this project is to increase the operational reliability of our RFPs at these two locations. The two that we have are solar-powered, and they're heavily utilized by students crossing the street at Heatherwood Middle School and Mill Creek Elementary. And since they're so heavily utilized during the fall and winter, where there's not enough sun to power them, they're not as reliable. So the button will be pushed and they don't activate. So in order to fix this, we applied for and were awarded the Transportation Improvement Board, TIB, Complete Streets Grant, which amounts to $300,000. So this is our first RRFB location. This is looking east on Trillium Boulevard at the entrance of Heatherwood Middle School. The beacons themselves are relatively small. They're located in between the pedestrian crossing signs that are located on these poles. At the top, you can see we have two solar panel units, which then charge a deep cycle marine battery at the top of the pole. You could also notice that there's plenty of trees around and foliage that don't let the sunlight through very well. This is the second location that we're looking at. This is looking east on 148th Street Southeast and 30th Avenue Southeast. This picture is taken from the entrance of the Red Cedar subdivision. It's located approximately 700 feet west of Mill Creek Elementary. So again, you can see this is the same unit. We have the rectangular beacons in between the signs. We have our batteries on top as well as the solar panels. And you can see all the shade that's being cast from the trees. So what we found, so these have been installed for about almost 10 years now. Have becoming increasingly unreliable during the fall and winter. One of the main reasons due to the sunlight availability, the angle of the sun, and the amount of hours of sunlight that we receive, as well as the batteries have to be replaced every so often. So the equipment's nearly 10 years old, and it's electronics, it's out in the weather. There's weather-resistant housing, but when it's out in the elements, it does eventually degrade. So what this unreliable operation gets us is increased calls to our police department, as well as the public works maintenance staff, when the system does not activate. Since they've been in there so long, people come to expect that these traffic control devices will function when the button's pushed, and when it doesn't, we definitely hear about it, and our crews have to go out, whether it be the police department or the maintenance staff, to evaluate the problem. So our project scope, so what we're going to do is we're going to replace these and upgrade them. To do that, we're going to bring on board a consultant to help us with this design. So what we've done is we've gone through the MRSC rosters. We sent out RFQs, requests for qualifications, to five consulting firms that specialize in traffic engineering, more specifically traffic engineering with electrical design components. Sent that out to RFQs out to five. We brought in three to interview and then selected one. We ended up selecting RH2 Engineering based on their qualifications and past experiences with these types of projects. So like I stated, we're going to hardwire them to AC power, so the power source is always there. We don't have to rely on the sun. In addition to that, while we're out there, we're going to look at the existing curb ramps and determine whether or not they're ADA compliant, and if they're not, we're going to go ahead and upgrade those since we're going to be out there upgrading the crossing. The last main item for this project scope is the evaluation of the school zone sign placement along the road. In talks, I've collaborated with our traffic officers within our police department to get a better idea of what they see out there in the field every day with terms of driver behavior and student behavior, and to see if there's anything that this project can do to assist them to help with enforcement and make the school zone safer for everybody. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at how the school zone signs are placed. There's been some cases where the signs aren't as visible, so we want to move those out and maybe expand the school zone, as well as by doing that, having more notification and drivers that they're entering the school zone that they should slow down to the appropriate speed limit. So we're going to be looking at that too. So project funding, like I stated, we applied for and were awarded a complete streets grant from the Washington Transportation Improvement Board. So that amount is for $300,000. So our first installment we received this past April, and on July 15th, we will be receiving the second installment. Now, I said $300,000, and the numbers on the screen do not add up to that. There's a $1,000 difference. I have two different letters in my correspondence with TIB. One letter they stated $107,000, and the next letter they stated $106,000. So I've been placing phone calls to them for the past, well, couple hours, trying to see if we can get that rectified. So I should have that answer by the end of the week. But other additional things, this is a no-match grant. So the city does not have to contribute anything to this. This is, everything is from TIB. The nice thing about this, too, is the deadline to spend the $300,000 is March 31st, 2022. So given that we have the March 31st, 2022 deadline, that's still quite a ways out. So we anticipate having this project finished well before then. So in the event that we do not spend the entire $300,000, we could potentially do two projects. Now, granted, this was completed with a high-level scoping and evaluation of what of some of the things we understand that the city needs. So I know the first item has been addressed before with this council. So, and I believe the direction that we've been given is to go ahead and complete a preliminary design so that everybody can visually see what this is going to look like. So we are currently working on that. So if we end up having money left over and the money amount looks to be within the range that we would suspect that the bike lane project would cost, then we would come to the council for concurrence before moving forward with that project. So
how likely is it that we wouldn't run right through the 300 grand that we get?
We can
kind of guesstimate what these projects would cost, right?
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm thinking, based off my past years of experience with public works projects, I estimate anywhere between $30,000 and $50,000 left over from this. Granted, that's been my experience. I know things change constantly, especially in the construction world. I believe there will be money left over, so these projects ballpark are within that range of what I would expect to have left over, if that's even the case. So, the second item is a pedestrian warning sign replacement at the mid-block crossings on Village Green Drive. I believe there's about a half dozen mid-block crossings. They're signed, but not necessarily signed consistently. So this would replace some of the older signs, and what you get with the new sign is a higher reflectivity of it, so it's more visible at nighttime. Generally, they'll remain the same yellow color, but that's another smaller project that we could use the funds for. That's something that we'd like to do. So, so our next steps. Our next step is to execute the professional services agreement with RH2 Engineering. Their design fee came in at less than $50,000, so we are not required to seek authorization from the city council. The city manager can sign off on this, but in the interest of being transparent and letting the council know where Public Works is at with this particular project, we felt it was best to give this presentation to you guys to let you know what is happening. Because otherwise you would see it when we're going to award the contract for construction. So, so after that gets executed, the schedule calls for having the design and plan specification estimate package completed by December 2019. So once that's completed, this project will go out to bid towards the mid to end December, and we'll probably let it run through mid-January. That time of year is a little more favorable bidding climate, or better time for agencies to get better bids on their work. The contractors at that time of year are looking to fill their plates for the spring and summer construction season. So we're hoping to get it out this early, out in the winter, we would get good bids on this project. So with that, then we would have construction planned for summer of 2020. And that construction would most likely start after mid-June when school is out, so there's no impact to the school traffic, because we are going to be fixing their crossings. So with that, that concludes the presentation, and I'd be willing to answer any questions that anybody has.
Brian, did you?
Do.
Okay. My thingy isn't working. Okay.
Start with the comment and then work backwards. On the bike lanes, I was one who, when I got on the council in 14, I think Mayor and I heard it on the campaign trail, and we urged the council to relook at the issue. As probably the only avid cyclist sitting up here, I ride Village Green Drive probably five times a week, and I've come to the conclusion putting bike lanes or markings on the Village Green Drive isn't going to do anything for safety. The biggest risk to cyclists is when we're riding on the right side of the road to stay out of traffic, the sight distance coming out of the developments, and I know Councilmember Todd isn't one of them, but Spring Tree drivers tend to be the worst. The sight distance coming out of those neighborhoods is horrible, so cars come way into the intersection. I can't tell you how many times I've been barreling down the road and I've got to jog into traffic to avoid getting hit. So the risk to cyclists and making it safer is not from the traffic on Village Green Drive. It's from the traffic coming out of the neighborhoods up and down Village Green Drive. I've probably had an incident over the last 5 years in every one of those developments. So I'm gone, done a 180. I'm not sure we need bike lanes markings on Village Green Drive. Back to this project. My question is, help educate me on ADA ramps.
Yes.
And the reason is, I think it was after I got on the council, I believe we spent $750,000, $800,000 redoing all the ramps on 35th, Village Green Drive, and 148th to make them ADA compliant. And I don't want to come across as not being sympathetic to the handicap, but I don't understand what changes in the design standards is constantly necessitating us redoing these ramps that we just spent a boatload of money reconstructing just, I think, within the last 5 or 6 years. It wasn't that long ago. So help me understand what has changed in the ADA standards that would make the new ramps more safe than what is there today.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's actually an excellent question, because when I was at Snohomish County Public Works, I was on the ADA compliance team, and I've surveyed tens of thousands of ramps and sidewalks. So basically, with the ADA ramps, what comes from that, so we mainly upgrade the ADA ramps when we're required by law whenever we touch a legal crossing on the street. There's a court case out of Pennsylvania that was basically ended up in the agency. If they repave the road, all the ADA ramps have to be redone because you've essentially now improved the crossing. So now that you've ground the pavement and you put a fresh layer down, crossing's better, so now you have to work your way out and redo the ADA ramps.
Well, maybe there's a simpler answer, because we got educated on that when we began discussing the pavement preservation plan and learned the difference, the different trigger between if we did chip seal or if we repaved.
Yes.
We don't mention those words chip seal around here very often anymore. So I asked the question because I took from your comment that we were electing to upgrade the ramps. So I wasn't clear if this improving the crosswalk would be a trigger that we'd be required under the ADA to do as part of this project.
So that's true. So what we'd like to do is, if we're out there doing concrete work, we would like to take that opportunity to upgrade the ramps, because eventually that road will have to be overlaid. So we're looking at it as a systematic approach of upgrading the ADA ramps. The problem is, if the ADA ramps don't get upgraded, since it's federal law, if we apply for any federal funding for public works projects, the FHWA or WSDOT, the steward of the FHWA funds that come down to the state, could revoke our funding for federally funded projects. So that's why we you know, if we're out there doing work, we want to upgrade the ADA ramps.
So it's not required. We would be being proactive in doing that.
Correct.
And if we're proactive, if we're proactive, are we going to get punished when you go in and do the overlay and then say, oh, you got to do it again, the standards changed?
No, the current standards haven't necessarily changed. They've just never been fully understood or enforced. So right now, the guidance that we follow is the 2005 PROAG. It's an ADA guidance. It's ADA document for what should be upgraded in the public right away. And there's been some minor changes proposed, but the current administration hasn't followed through with updating those rules. So we haven't seen. I don't anticipate those being updated anytime soon. And in fact, some of the regulations that they would change would be the width of some of the ramps and whatnot. But for the most part, the cross slopes and running slopes and the fact that we have to have detectable boring surface at the base of the ramps would stay the same. So
we're not going to, when we do overlays, in 5 years, you're not going to be standing here saying, oops, we got to do it again.
I hope not.
Okay. And then I just have a couple more questions.
Yes.
The $300,000 grant that we're using to pay for the study out here, that's a completely separate $300,000. So that's covered, and this is different. Good deal. Okay. And then I go to work that way every day, 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen the lights fail to activate, usually when I'm late for work. So... and I agree with you about the signs not being visible. Could we perhaps do some tree trimming out there? You're right. They're in the trees. I can't see it. I know it's there. But have we looked at doing some tree trimming to make things more visible?
Yes, we can most certainly do that. Yes.
Okay. And then you said you were looking at designs for the bike lanes. Brian and I did hear that on the campaign trail, and there was an extensive design done.
Okay.
And so that paperwork, Tom Gathman did it. It has to be here someplace.
Okay.
For you to look at and see what he was proposing. It may just save you some time and work.
Okay, will do.
Councilmember Todd, and then John, I'm calling on you.
Thanks. So for me, these things, this is one of the things I'd like us to get to someday, go from our guiding principles and our goals to some objectives and some strategic priorities. And for me, I think of a strategic priority, I'm going to float it out there, is that this is a walkable, safe community. And if that's our priority overall, I think an objective is getting our safe routes to schools so it's mm-hmm. safe for kids to walk to schools. And so this RRFB fits into the safe routes for schools. I think there's other places, as one of our citizens mentioned, I designated the same spots a memo I sent out to the city manager earlier today. There's places where we have kids walking on the shoulder, only protected by a fog line, or with places where there's crosswalks that aren't marked, that are fairly close to our schools. And for me, that is the highest priority. We've had our bike advocate already say that bike lanes on Village Green Drive isn't the best use of our funds, probably. I think you kind of said that. And we as a council decided that several years ago. Just the stuff is filed away, but it's probably filed pretty deep because this council said no bike lanes on Village Green Drive. We have more important issues. There's been many of us have been here for a lot of years. I think there's a disparity between how we treat Village Green Drive and how we treat Silvercrest Drive or other parts of Heatherwood West area. We've got to fix places in this city that don't have adequate sidewalks or adequate protection, even if it's just RPMs or candles or better lines or painted crosswalks, much, much more important for me. And so I'm not interested in the bike lanes. I don't think we should spend any more time or money on that. You can go find the old stuff in your spare time and look at that, but it's not worth doing. Renewing the signs on Village Green Drive, same thing. We have bigger problems to solve. If we get beyond safe routes to schools, I think safe routes to transit makes sense. There's a missing sidewalk that's over by the Mill Creek Sports Park on Trillium Drive there's a place, there's a crosswalk that goes to nowhere, and it is where you'd really like to walk to go to the bus or to Heatherwood Middle School. You end up going 1,000 feet out of your way if you want to cross where you're legally supposed to. We're going to spend a bajillion dollars on a pedestrian signal on the highway. I think we should spend a few dollars on fixing that issue right here in our own city. So for the safety of the kids, the convenience of our walking community, that's families, it's kids, it's old people, it's schools, that's the important thing we should do. And I would drop these two other ideas. I'm also amazed at how much this costs. I'd be interested to know what it costs. I don't think those went in 2010, but if they did, I'd be interested to know what it costs. I can't believe our RFBs in two sites are going to cost us that. I know it's going to take a little effort to dig up some wires, but we should have more than a little bit left over out of the $300K. Final comment is, yep, you have to spend the money by 2022 or you lose it, but if you spend it by the end of 2020, you get a chance to get more. And so our deadline ought to be to get this done by the end of next year so we can apply for another grant. And the way you get more grants, more money on this particular grant, is to show past performance and future plans. So if we've got a plan that says we want a safe, walkable community, show that we've done a good job with the money last time, I can't guarantee it, but we'd sure be in line for more money than this time. So I think there's a lot of things we could do on this to do a lot better. Sorry to be negative, but we've got to do right by our community, and we've got to do right by the best use of our funds. Thanks.
John, do you have any questions or comments? That's you.
Sorry, I'm having trouble getting the mute up. No questions. Good comments. I agree with especially the comments that Councilmember Todd just said. I agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with Councilmember Todd, too, that just because that they work when I'm going by, I can tell you there's no way you can see those kids in their dark clothes at 7 o'clock in the morning in the winter. And safety has got to be the top priority. They're not looking. They hit the button and go. And thank God that those signs are there to at least alert us that somebody's crossing. So I am totally supportive of that because it's just too big a chance of something going wrong. And I also agree with Councilmember Todd that we have areas that it's not safe to walk on. And I would definitely like to see us approach taking care of those first. And I'm really glad to hear Mike say that if we do a good job here, we can apply for a grant to take care of that. So I'm supportive of definitely taking care. And I even when I came back from AWC, I brought the city manager all sorts of information on new signs. I think that they're really important. So anybody else?
Do you have a list of some other areas started where we might need? I mean, you alluded to a few of the areas. Does the city have a list, or is staff generating a list so we could at some point kind of look at on a map some areas where we could be focusing?
I think that's a great suggestion if we're not already doing it.
So thank you for the question. So before this meeting, I looked in our comprehensive plan, which I can't, that's the document that I have. There are three locations in the cities that are missing sidewalks on both sides of the street. So one is Silvercrest Drive, another one North Creek Drive going towards Trillium, and then another one SR 527 on the south side of the city. Other locations have sidewalk on one side of the street, but not the other, and so forth.
Mike?
One of my favorite, and I think that's true at the highest level, but I'll use my neighborhood as an example. Springtree, one of the first neighborhoods built around here, it's pavement, and it has RPMs that delineate what the sidewalk is. But that doesn't stop people from parking on the sidewalk. And so the kids walk around the cars that are parked on the sidewalk, out into the road. That's a dangerous situation at 7 in the morning when it's dark. Would we allow someone to park on the sidewalk where there's, in Brian's neighborhood, where there's a real sidewalk? We'd give them a ticket, but we don't enforce that in Springtree. Some of the older neighborhoods, there's a lot of Doug Fir. It's not just the first neighborhood. It's a bunch of them. Yeah. So renewing the no parking signs, painting on the pavement, no parking. This is a sidewalk. I'll volunteer to paint those. Give me the stencil. We'll get some community volunteers to go do it. But we need to mark those sidewalks, and we need to instill in people that it's important that this is a walkable community. we, the Cook property owners, are guilty of a lot of kids walking along North Creek Drive. It's a wide shoulder, and it's a wide fog line, but it is still unprotected, and people don't go 25 on that road. They go quite a bit faster. RPMs along there wouldn't be very expensive. Some no parking signs, some something that says this is a sidewalk, that'd be great.
And enforcement.
And enforcement.
Which I've never seen anybody, they park, but I've never seen a ticket on a car.
Just making it obvious and making the focus that this is important to us, I think would help. We don't have to have the cops watching every one of them, but I think it's just getting the word out that you can't park on our sidewalks, you can't drive on our sidewalks, quote unquote, would help us quite a bit. I think it's that we need to have a philosophy about how do we mark the places where we don't have a sidewalk that's separated by a curb and a difference in elevation. Important to us, what do we do along Silvercrest Drive? That's another road that's...
Hey, Councilmember Bond Van Holtzclaw.
Thank you, Mayor. So, back in 1992, I was the graveyard car, and if I was lucky enough to have a sergeant work with me, usually it was Crannell, maybe three or four, I'm not sure exactly, but we would start at one end of town and we would pass each other and we wrote tickets, and we, because the council at that time said this is what we want, and we did it. It wasn't sexy police work, it wouldn't have made for a great episode of Cops or anything like that, but we got to where we would meet each other halfway and you got anybody? Nope. And we didn't end up writing many tickets because people got compliant. Then we found out, as we continued to do that, when we did stumble into a car that was non-compliant, it was rarely someone who was there. You know, they might have been visiting, but they weren't a resident. So most of the time it was a guest making a mistake. Occasionally it was someone in there that was there for some no good reasons, and they stood out to us because the parking was so compliant otherwise because of our fairly aggressive approach. It was like a $30 ticket, but it was pain and people didn't like it. Well, I'm no longer a Mill Creek guy, and I can't say for what Mill Creek is doing to address the parking problems. I will tell you, in my neighborhood, over Highland Trails and then up Silver, 25th, it's narrow, and people do park on the actual sidewalk all the time because it's lipped. And every time I see it, it drives me nuts, especially on a sunny Saturday or a Sunday, and some lady's walking her dog or crib or whatever, you know, a little carriage thing, and going out into the street to go around the car. And I'm like, oh, where's the cops when you need them? So fast forward now, in the city of Sultan, a small bedroom community, and guess what? Council has a passion for the parking issues in Sultan and has directed us that serve the citizens of Sultan to be more aggressive about it. And what we came up with, our code enforcement officer and I, came up with a bright orange sticker. It's fairly large, that has a number of the common violations, and you'd check a box and date and time, and it was just a warning, just saying, hey, you're on the sidewalk, or your tabs are expired, or you're facing the wrong way. Or you've been here for over 72 hours. Sultan allows you to park 72 hours, and then you need to move your car. Can't just be abandoned, essentially. So I just throw that out. As a police officer, I really don't like writing a nice person a $30 ticket, but if I can throw a sticker on there saying, hey, maybe you didn't know, maybe you didn't, but you're on the sidewalk, you're parked wrong way, you're blah, 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 this is the violation, please correct it. And we've gotten some I'm pretty happy with the amount of compliance that we've gotten without having to write the tickets to good folks who, you know, 30 bucks is 30 bucks. I mean, so I just throw it out there that that's what we did to our chief. Chief, you want to chime in on what you think is going on nights or in that, you know, to address this as opposed to us speculating.
Well, it's ironic that we're having this discussion because this was a topic of conversation in the squad room today. We got a correspondence from the MCCA about a couple of different issues, and parking was one of them. So there's a couple of issues that are difficult to address. I can tell you my neighborhood, like some of the other neighborhoods, has raised pavement markers that designate where the sidewalk is. a third or more of those raised pavement markers have gone missing over the years. And the sign that's across the street from my house that hangs on the tree that says no parking is unreadable because it's completely faded. So my response to Hillary at MCCA today included that, hey, listen, we've got a bigger thing. And I copied my colleague in Public Works on the email, and, you know, we've got a bigger thing. It's ironic that this conversation has taken this turn. But one of the things that we talked about along your lines, Mark, was a little handout. We've considered coming to council and asking what your thoughts are on allowing people to pay their parking tickets with food bank donations or something along those lines. Because we want to, it's not about making money, it's about addressing the issue and correcting the problem. So your sticker idea is one. We talked about just a little colorful flyer that's a friendly note from your local police department saying, hey, you're doing this. Your left wheel's to the curb or you're parked on top of the raised pavement markers. And then just concluding with, pay this gesture of goodwill forward and consider making a donation to the food bank. So we're kind of brainstorming that idea. But on a bigger level, we do want to consider, and other cities have done this, in lieu of your $34 parking ticket, you know, you can make a charitable donation to the food bank or offset the cost or some of those things. We currently allow people to pay their parking tickets half price. If they show up at the front counter within 24 hours of receiving it, they get a 50% discount. So there may be another mechanism in there. As far as what's happening, I don't have hard numbers on numbers of tickets issued, but as part of our discussion, I did have staff pull the numbers of mitigated, contested, and FTA tickets. And so that's going to represent some percentage of the number of tickets that were written. Well, in I think we had, was a page and a half. So along the lines of 50 or 60 FTAs mitigated or contested in the last year. So that's going to represent the number of how many parking tickets we've actually written. Maybe half of all parking tickets, maybe a third or some other number. So we're out there writing them. We do a lot of education. One of the officers I talked to today says, I don't like to write parking tickets for all the reasons you mentioned. So I'll go knock on however many doors I need to knock on until I find the person who's responsible for the car. And in that same vein, it's most of the time visitors. The one this morning that they discussed was the babysitter had come to pick up the kid and was there longer than they'd expected to be. So what you experienced a few years ago is similar to what we're experiencing now, just on a little bit larger scale because of more streets now.
Through the chair, just a quick question, Chief. Do you have an opinion on the warning sticker or the warning?
Yeah, that fits right in line with what we were talking about today. And I'm hesitant to put a sticker on anybody's car because somebody's going to not like sticky residue once they peel it off. But, you know, a nice colored half sheet of paper flyer or something along those lines with some nice message on it and something that we can just tuck underneath the windshield wiper and say we were here and please don't do that again.
Chief, you need to be careful with putting colored paper on the cars as someone who used to do that because we get so much rain and it can fade the color onto the car.
We never got
that
deep.
I used to do that in the apartments, so I know that can be a problem.
I appreciate that. We never got that deep in the conversation, but that's certainly something that we need to think about because it's wet here. So whatever we put on cars needs to withstand that.
Mayor?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand. I think all of our comments in this discussion is focused on what to do if there is any leftover money. I support the core project of these two crossings. I have seen them not work. I've been there. You're probably not aware when I moved here in the early 2000s, the crosswalk wasn't even at Red Cedar. It was about 75, 100 yards to the west. The trail kind of curved from where it does now. And just a couple years ago, they took out the old post from where the crosswalk used to be. So I was wondering, why is the crosswalk there at Red Cedar and not at Mill Creek Elementary School? Because I'm still maybe it's just a Washington driver thing, but I've never ceased to be amazed how many times I'll go to the crosswalk at Brighton and stand there and watch four or five cars drive by, seeing people standing there waiting to cross, and they don't stop. So has any thought been given to whether or not that lit crosswalk should be at the school rather than up at Red Cedar?
No, we have not looked into that. But that's definitely something we could investigate as to why that particular crossing, why the RRFBs are located down at Red Cedar and not in front of Brighton, because I know both crosswalks are marked. And, in fact, I was out there last month on the last day of school for traffic observation with the principal. So that's something we could look into.
I think it'd be worth looking into. I mean, during the school hours, they do have the crossing guards in the morning and at night. But, you know, I see the kids before school when I'm leaving for work coming up the 148th. And most of the kids I see using that crosswalk for school or for the middle schoolers going to the bus stop, which is right across the street on 148th. Most of the elementary school kids out of Red Cedar obviously walk up that side, and the other kids walk from Cottonwood, from Mayor's neighborhood, would walk up the other side of the street and then cross at the school usually.
Yeah, and you brought up a good point. I suspect that's probably because they do have the crossing guard out there for 15, 20 minutes before or after school, so you have that active traffic control out in the street, but that's something I could look into.
I think it's worth some thought, and I'd be interested to know what the school district thinks, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mike.
So there's some history there. Remember the path around Red Cedar used to be way back in the bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when that crosswalk got moved from that mid-block crossing where the meter base is still there but it's no longer used. It got moved to Red Cedar because that was a better location. But since then, we've added the sidewalk that comes down that slope and goes properly to the intersection of 148th and Village Green Drive. So this is a sequence of stuff over the years. It got moved to a better location. It was mid-block, at least they moved it to Red Cedar. Somewhere along the way, it got RRFB added to it. I don't know when it was. I can't picture 2010, but maybe it did. But since then, we've added that other thing. And so your point you're raising is maybe just eliminate that crosswalk entirely is a better solution.
Well, I think you still need a crosswalk there because of the bus stop location across for the kids for the middle school.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think it's worth at least asking the question and giving it some thought of whether that other location makes more sense. I don't know that it does or doesn't, but.
Through the chair, as a result of that, we just had a really quick sidebar conversation. We're going to explore that very question. We're going to follow up in tomorrow's leadership meeting on it. Sounds like there's some real merit to it. Police Chief Owen has a strong opinion on it as well. So it may be very well that we're going to move it.
Let's make sure the folks that live in Red Cedar are included in that conversation, too. I think
yeah, good point.
They're going to be directly impacted. They should be the ones that have a very loud voice.
Michael, if I may, since I have you all here and we ended up having this discussion, is there any energy on the part of the council to explore some sort of alternatives to parking ticket fees like donations to the food bank or something along those lines? I mean, you can get into a baseball game with a can of green beans sometimes, so I think.
Councilmember Bond?
So I was going to say something, but it's a bit off topic of what we're really addressing. What I want to say first off is I hope we can – I would really like us on a slow council night to maybe do a discussion on parking enforcement, noise ordinance violations, traffic enforcement, and just a briefing on sort of what y'all are doing and how you're doing it. It's the quality of life stuff that people call all the time about. You know, we're always ramping up for the shootings and all that fun stuff, but people call every day about my neighbor's dog and the neighbor that's parking wonky. So I'd like to talk about it. I will say off just as a – I like where your heart is on the food bank thing, but I don't like it. I think you guys have a lot of tools. They do exactly what I do. I knock on doors. I ask people to comply. I either sometimes I'll put a stick on their thing saying do this. And if after I've made an honest effort in my heart to try and get compliance, then it's a ticket. And it's not a trip to the food bank. You're paying your $30. I'm done trying to get you to do the right thing. I gave you every opportunity, and we're just not getting there any other way. And it's got to hurt a little for people to change at that point. So I would say, I'm not telling your people to write tickets, but if they choose to use that as their tool, then that person can either pay it or contest it or do whatever their options are. But I think most of your people that I've interacted with are pretty darn reasonable. So at the point that they've decided a ticket is the right solution, they've probably exhausted a lot of other options, or the violation was just so egregious that they felt it was appropriate to, you know, completely wonky on the sidewalk, half in the front, you know, something ridiculous. So that's my thoughts on, I'll hear you out if we want to talk about it more, but just my knee-jerk reaction is if at that point you guys are writing the ticket, they can pay the ticket.
I agree with Mark, and it's one thing for somebody to park there for 5 minutes. I mean, they shouldn't do it, but they do. But you want to find a way to deal with your frequent flyers, because the people that I see do it all the time, because there's no cost. So I don't know how you would deal with that. Councilmember Todd.
I was going to say, I like the idea of educating people. Give them a chance to do the right thing. But with Councilmember Bond, if they can't be educated, then they need to have some other sort of pain. So I would love to see us have easier flyers. They don't have to go knock on doors and try to find somebody. But a piece of paper says, gosh, maybe you weren't aware, this is a violation, this is your warning. And it doesn't have to be official warning that you guys write out with the license number stuff. It's just you stick it on there, and it's white, so it doesn't stain anybody's car. But it's just a white piece of paper that says, maybe you weren't aware. And after a couple of those, your officers will know that, okay, I've already done three of these on this car. To me, it's the frequent flyers that I see a lot is the landscape guys. Oh, I'm only going to be there for 20 minutes. Well, during that 20 minutes, some kid's walking by, some lady with a carriage, some dad with a dog. They're walking in the street. Any time is too long. That is just shouldn't be allowed, because you wouldn't allow that in Brian's neighborhood where he's got a real curb. People wouldn't drive up on the curb and park. The landscape guy would find another place to park. He can't do that where we designate the sidewalk. And places like Silvercrest Drive, where we get to decide which side is the sidewalk, which side is parking, because that's just a bad situation waiting to happen up there.
I just don't want the message to come out that we want to be happy about, maybe happy is the wrong word, but we want to be beating down windshields with tickets either. This is still a very... we police very well here. The conversation, the knock on the door, kind of like Mark was saying, kind of like the chief was saying. Sure, there has to be enforcement. I totally support and get that. But at the same sense, you know, I think someone, I'm not sure who brought it up about the babysitter that came to watch the kid or pick him up. I mean, for the $50 she's going to make, I don't want to take 30 of it for a ticket. I would think we're in the business for the wrong reasons at that point. So it's a good topic to discuss at some point, but there has to be some sort of formula we include in there as well.
Brian?
How much is our parking ticket, and what in the last couple of years has been our average total revenue from issuing parking tickets?
Funny you should ask. 34 is a basic number. It goes up to 250 for a handicap parking ticket violation. Well, I should ask Barbara knows all the answers to this question. Other than the revenue, I did send an email off to Jody today asking for the revenue information so I can start making some educated decisions on what we're doing.
Great, thanks.
Hey, anybody else tonight on this?
I have one comment, Mayor.
Yes, John.
I wanted to agree. I think it's rather important. I live in a neighborhood, too, that does not have physical sidewalks, older neighborhood. And I do get violators, and I sincerely support repeat violators being ticketed. But I also want to support that we give the first violator a warning, because sometimes it can be a guest at somebody's home that came and didn't realize, and I don't think it sends a great message to ticket them if it's their first time. But if it's a repeat violator, I support 100% ticketing and enforcing that, because I do agree that it puts citizens, especially children, at risk. But warning on the first violation, ticketing after that.
So, do you have what you need, Michael?
Beg your pardon?
Do you have what you need from the council?
Yes, we did. This was excellent feedback, and we appreciate it.
Okay, so moving on.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You can sit now, Matt.
And you did a first good presentation. First presentation was good. So.
Yes, excellent. Thank you.
So now we're up to old business, the server upgrades. Just so you know, I sent James
20 questions last night. And I apologize. It's completely my fault. He didn't get them earlier, but I had a medical problem. So, and we received emails today with the information. There's 11 meg of data, and I have not had an opportunity to review it, so, which was not James's fault. It was, I have a day job. So, with that, City Manager?
Thank you, Mayor. Mr. Bush is here to present on the additional information that was requested, as well as any other follow-up questions from the prior presentations. James?
So in your blue folders, Gina provided a copy of the PowerPoint presentation if you want to follow along. And Mr. Steckler, hopefully you received the email from Gina if you want to follow along. If not, I'll do my best to keep you up to speed here.
John, can you hear okay?
I can hear okay, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so the first question was in regards to the purchasing process. It was, can the council see the RFP and the responses? So this project is over $50,000, and so there's an RFP process, and it was how many vendors were contacted and what were their bids. And so what this process is through a group called KCDA, and that stands for the King County Directors Association. And what they are is they're a group that helps with processes like this, and they comply with all Washington state laws for the RFP process, and they do a lot of the legwork. So products like this that are purchased by lots of different agencies, so we don't have to go and do the RFP process multiple times at all the different agencies. They will go out and they will do the RFP process for us. They publish in newspaper the notices. They write up the contract documents. They review the bid process, the bid responses, make sure that it's all up to snuff, and then they will award the contract to the best and most responsive bidder. They're audited every year by the Washington State auditors to make sure that they are complying with all Washington State laws. And so they were the vendor that we're going with. They were awarded the contract. It's number 018A. And in the email that I sent, there's a link to all the bid documents for you to review if you'd like. And there was quotes from three different vendors. And that's on this slide here. There was the Nutanix quote, the Scale Computing quote, and the Dell VX Rail quote with the costs up there at the top. The Nutanix and Scale were both pretty close to the $50,000, and the Dell being at about $66,000 when you include taxes. And we discussed in the previous council meetings why I was recommending the Nutanix product. So question number two. Was I'd like to see your written needs assessment. This should have included storage needs, amount, and actual frequency of access. And so for this, what I had done was use a product that runs on the servers, and it collects storage requirements, it collects CPU utilization, memory utilization, and so recommend you run this at least for 24 hours to get, you know, an average daily usage. And so I ran this back in May, and it collected all sorts of data, spit out a report. It was like 14 pages long, maybe longer, and so that was included in the email that I sent as well. But, you know, the important information is that we were using about 112 gigabytes of RAM, two terabytes of storage, varying CPU utilization throughout the day depending on what the workload was. In general, our CPU usage is low. The storage level's not critical. You can kind of see in there it has total used and free capacity, total combined capacity. There's a lot of information in there, but it's pretty much down in the weeds. But, you know, high-level storage is not at a critical level. We have a little bit of room to grow. But we are growing. So question three, what are the business requirements that each department gave for your services running on the servers? These should be written documents included in your analysis. So what we have in our IT policy is that any software or hardware that's running on the network It needs to be compatible with the city's computer network, and it needs to have a legitimate business use. We're not just going to be running personal stuff at the city, and we're not just going to run software for whatever reason. It needs to have a legitimate business use. And also, software cannot be installed without the IT manager's authorization. That's me. And I'm going to have the final decision regarding the appropriateness of any changes to the network. And so, due to our size, we try to look for efficiencies and not just have bureaucracy. So we'll have meetings to decide, hey, is this software good or bad for the network? Do we really need it? And so we'll sit down, the leadership team and me, and ultimately it comes down to, was this budgeted for? And it's a city manager decision of if we're going to buy software and use it. And so while we don't have a written document or business requirement document that we go through for this, any software that we install, it's always vetted through the IT manager and through the city manager before we install it or use it. So question four, can we see your written disaster recovery plan to restore services back to City Hall if the server goes down at City Hall? Is the cost of restoring service included in your non-cloud cost estimates? What does it cost per year for your practice backups per the disaster recovery plan? How does the cost of your disaster recovery plan compare with recovery from the cloud? So this is a great question. So this was an item that was brought up during the IT audit that was done by the State Auditor's Office back in 2015. They had estimated that to bring in a third party to help with this, because I'm not necessarily a disaster recovery expert, they had said we could bring in a third party, and they had estimated $75,000 to $100,000 to put together this disaster recovery plan. I think that's a little bit high for an organization our size, but this is something that I talked with the previous city manager, including in the last budget, but it did not get funded. It's something that I would love to have done so we have a better holistic approach to a disaster recovery plan. And so maybe it's something that we could include in a future budget to do. I do have plans to restore our city servers. We have backup systems, and so we would be able to restore should a failure occur. I don't want to go into a ton of detail in a public meeting for just, you don't want to tell the hackers how to get your backups and what your plan are for recovery. If anybody wants to talk about it, I'd be happy to discuss that one-on-one. For backup, so how much do you need by category, and how much data is being backed up, and how frequently? I wasn't sure about the category question. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that. We back up everything. We want to be able to restore all the data, so we back up everything that's important so we can do a full restore if a server goes down. So that totals to approximately 2 terabytes of data. We have multiple recovery points, so we can go back in time. So if somebody deletes a file a week ago, we can go back to that week ago time point and restore it, not just to the backup yesterday and say, well, sorry, you deleted it a week ago. So the backup is bigger than just the amount of data that we have to back up, if that makes sense. So we can go back to multiple points in time and do a restore. That's also for purposes like ransomware, if your files get encrypted, or from ransomware, maybe you don't know about it for a week or so, and you might need to go back 2 weeks in time and restore to recover from the ransomware. So we have multiple recovery points. So question six, what is the cost of running the server room, including a rack and switch infrastructure? Are those costs included in your analysis of cloud versus non-cloud costs? So I don't know if I'm fully answering the question, but even if we were to take all of our servers and put them in the cloud, we still have the other servers that need to be running back there, such as our phone system server. We have a security camera DVR. We have a key card server system that's running back there. So the server room would still need to be back there. It's a pretty small room, 9 feet by 9 feet. So that room would remain, and that wouldn't go away even if we were to move all of our servers to the cloud. And so the only significant cost that I could see that would go away would be the electricity required to run those servers. And I looked at the electricity bill and did some math, and it's about $100, $150 a month in electricity that it costs to run those servers. Getting a little behind on the questions here. So question seven, are we going to need to replace the servers in Yakima, the backup servers that we have? When and how much will that cost? Would we need two servers in Yakima if we were in the cloud? So those backup servers, they were purchased in 2017, and those were purchased with a five-year service agreement and warranty on them. And so they're scheduled for replacement evaluation in 2022. So I wouldn't say they're scheduled for replacement, but that's when we would evaluate them because the service agreement on them is up. So if they're still meeting our needs, they still have enough capacity, we would possibly extend their life beyond 2022. As it shows there, their cost when we purchased them in 2017 was roughly $22,000. And there I included, again, the comparison. Those were included, the three-year backup cost. So I took the cost of those backup servers, which includes a primary and a secondary backup that's in Yakima, as well as what it costs to house the one in Yakima and the data transport, and that math works out to the $15,000 a year, or actually the three-year cost for that backup server, the primary and the secondary, if we keep the servers on site here. So question eight, could money be saved on cloud access by turning services off on? Can you build scripts to facilitate the savings? If the computing time is turned off for several server hours each day, for example, 9 p.m. to 5 a.m., would there be a cost savings? If so, how much? This also relates to your business needs analysis. Is every department using computing time 24 hours per day? So this is a great question, because one of the selling points of cloud is that if you don't need it, you can turn it off. You don't pay for it anymore. They bill you by the hour, etc. So when I did the evaluation of our servers, I couldn't find any significant amount of money that could be saved. And part of that goes into the way that Microsoft charges for the servers. They charge one price for pay-as-you-go, which allows you to turn them on and turn them off, and then you get billed hourly. That's the pay-as-you-go. Or you pay for reserved instance services. And a reserved instance is where you commit to running a server for 1 year, because it's a dedicated server, or 3 years. And just like anything else, if you commit to running it for a certain amount of time, you get a greater discount for it. And so the price goes up as you use pay-for-go licensing, pay-as-you-go licensing. So the example is $356 a month for pay-as-you-go, or $136, $137 a month if you commit to three-year reserved instance licensing. So in effect, if you're able to turn off a server for 8 out of 24 hours in a day, there's not a significant reduction in cost savings, because the price has gone up so much per hour and you're only able to turn it off for 8 hours a day. It's a pretty high break even when you try to only turn it off for 8 hours a day. In addition, when we look at our servers here, due to the nature of our operations at the city, most of our servers need to be on 24 hours a day anyway, so it makes sense to go with the committed three-year reserved instance. So examples are 24/7 PD operations. They need to be able to log in 24 hours a day. Our monitoring systems that need to alert us if something goes down, that needs to be on 24/7. We have servers that are auditing our logins for FBI criminal justice information system requirements. Those need to be collecting their logs all the time. Our authentication servers need to be able to authenticate our police officers that are working 24/7. We run an online building permit system. Somebody could apply for a permit any time of the day. We don't know when. They might be doing it in their pajamas at 1 in the morning. Sometimes we have emergency work. Public Works gets called in for an emergency, and they need to work as well. And then we also have other systems, such as our antivirus servers, that are constantly updating our antivirus definition. So those are just some examples of why most of our servers need to be online all the time. There's a couple servers I identified that possibly could have that on-off, on-off type of thing. But I think due to the other items that I mentioned on the last slide, I think it would be a pretty minimal cost savings. So question 9, how many internet access wires are leaving the building? Are there at least two going in different physical directions in case of a loss of service? So we do have two separate internet connections for redundancy. They come in through two separate conduits into the building for the reasons that are kind of obvious here, to make sure that if one gets cut, the other one doesn't as well. So 10, with the new server, will you be adding a third internet provider? The answer to that is no. We have the primary and the secondary, and that's working out quite well. 11, why a Microsoft SQL Server instead of an Apache server? So that's dictated by the software requirements by the software vendors. They design their software to work with a certain database engine, and they've required the Microsoft SQL Server, so that's why that's what we're running. And there's a potential that if that were to be moved into the Microsoft Azure cloud, that the cost could go up for that. They don't, when you run a Microsoft SQL Server in the cloud, they don't let you bring your existing licensing with you to the cloud. They want you to relicense that when you bring it up to the cloud. So question 12, have you considered an offline or less expensive data storage server for police videos? What's your analysis of services that should not have access to the internet? So this is something that we've looked at in the past for storing large files separate from our normal servers. And what we ran into is that those are more difficult to maintain because you have some files in one location and other files in another, and then how do you back those up? How do you make sure that those are being retained to the Washington State retention laws? There's police evidence concerns. Are they stored in a secure location? Are they kept where they should be? There's disaster recovery concerns. So if the data is stored on our servers where they're backed up and automatically replicated off-site, then you know that they're safe for recovery if a disaster were to hit to the building. Whereas with an offline storage that's stored one place, you're not sure that it's kept off-site. And it would be another appliance to purchase and maintain, and it would probably drive up costs. As far as the second part of the question, services not have access to the internet. We do have some services that are on a separate part of the network. They're firewalled off and kept separate so they don't go on the internet if they don't need to. 13, is the $50,000 cost for replacing one server or two? If you have two servers now, when will you need a second server? Will that be another $50,000? So the Nutanix proposal is they call it a three node. It's three servers. So we have two servers now, two physical servers. And the Nutanix proposal is three servers, and that improves the redundancy and the resiliency of the system, adds the fault tolerance. So with the current growth, the Nutanix proposal should be sufficient for the life of the servers, which is estimated to be 5 to 7 years. Now, their proposal includes 3 years of support and maintenance built in, and then at the end of the 3 years, like we discussed last week, that's when we would have a check-in point and decide if they're still meeting our needs, are they still have useful life in them, and then we could decide if we want to continue with support and maintenance or move to the cloud. If we decide to continue, that's approximately $5,000 a year at today's pricing to continue the support and maintenance into like the fourth year or fifth year or sixth year, however long we decide to continue with them. If we did have huge unexpected growth, that's where you could add one more node. It wouldn't be another $50,000 increase. You can add on incrementally as you need more capacity. So it'd be approximately a third the price because we're buying the $50,000 is three nodes. It could be possibly even less as prices go down, or just if they change their pricing structure. We're buying a whole entire chassis with three servers in it, so we wouldn't have to buy the chassis again. It would be adding one more server into the existing server chassis. That's why it's possibly less. And something else I thought of, Brian, I think this is what you were alluding to last week, and I wasn't quite catching on, is you were asking about the useful life of the server beyond the 3 years. And so I looked at it more as even a 5-year, because the Microsoft Azure cloud pricing that is a per year price for everything. They keep making you pay for it every year, every year. And so this chart's maybe a little difficult to grasp at first, but the on the far left here you have the Nutanix 3-year and the Azure 3-year, and they total up down here to the total 3-year costs. And then you have the Nutanix 5-year. And as I mentioned, beyond the third year, you would have to pay maintenance again at approximately $5,000 a year. And so if we add on a couple more years to that, that would increase that by $10,000, and we'd multiply out some backup costs as well. And so the 3-year costs would go up. But with the Azure Cloud, these are all per-year prices that would go up by the same amount per year. And so you can see where the 5-year pricing for the cloud has a much steeper curve as you go on every single year, where the Nutanix has a much slower curve because you've made your initial investment in it. You've bought the servers, you own them, and so now you have these smaller incremental maintenance costs on something that you already own. And so you can see this down here, this difference. And after 3 years, the difference between a Nutanix and the cloud, you have a $95,000 cost savings. But then after, if you compare a total 5-year price between Nutanix and the cloud, you have an even larger cost savings if you keep the system for 5 years. I think it was mentioned last week, you know, it's the analogy of buying a car and paying maintenance on it versus leasing a car and just paying to basically rent the car for many years. The longer you can own the car and just pay maintenance on it, the greater the cost savings. And so while I only compared the 3-year previously, again, the longer we keep it, the more money we're going to save. And we could even keep it for 7 years, and this would be even extended on how much money we would save. So question 14, is Nutanix considered a Tier 1 or Tier 2 product? Are HP and Dell considered Tier 1? Does Microsoft use Nutanix servers? If not, why not? So I wasn't sure about this question, Tier 1, Tier 2. I did some Googling, and the Tier 1 and Tier 2 seem to refer to like automotive manufacturing and who makes the products initially versus who makes the components for the products. I don't know if you have want to expand on the question at all.
No, I just need time to sit and digest everything.
Okay. So I will say that, you know, HP and Dell, you know, they're definitely big players, and they make a lot of their own products.
Well, Nutanix isn't making this product. Supermicro is.
That's correct. So Nutanix is a software company. They make software. You can put Nutanix on a Dell. You can put Nutanix on HP. You can put Nutanix on Lenovo. Or you can buy it all from one company, and you can buy it from Nutanix, and they will provide the hardware that they've tested it on, which is the Supermicro. And Supermicro makes systems for a lot of different companies. Our email archiver is made by Supermicro, the hardware. And so it's they're good systems. The hard drives are made by companies that you've heard of. The memory is made by a company that you've heard of. Supermicro just kind of packages it all together and provides it to Nutanix because that's who they've chosen to go through. And I think what's most important is the support that you get with the system. And that's where, you know, you can read the reviews, you can talk to references, and it's a company that stands behind their product. And I don't think that if it was a bad product, they would slap their name on it and that they would sell it. They would find a different company to provide the hardware for it. And if it was failing, I mean, they have to warranty it and send replacement parts. They wouldn't sell a product that's going to fail that they're going to have to support. And as I mentioned before, it comes highly recommended by Redmond, Arlington, Marysville, and, you know, all the other companies that use it in the area. So question 15, one of the cloud costs is $80,000. This is for the internet connection that would be necessary. How much bandwidth does that provide? Can we see your analysis of how much bandwidth is actually needed? So this is for the 1 gigabit connection to the Microsoft cloud. It's called the Microsoft Azure Express route. And so where that need comes from is from the system requirements from the various software applications. So these applications were designed to run on a local network. From, like I mentioned before, from my office to the server room, which is a 1 gigabit low latency connection. And so this screenshot here is from the Microsoft Server 2016 system requirements. This is the network adapter requirements, and it says at a minimum, an Ethernet adapter capable of at least a gigabit throughput connection. And so that's the system requirements from Microsoft Server 2016. And so you wouldn't want anything lower than that, or you're going to be setting yourself up for problems and failure from the beginning. So what is your redundant connectivity for what is already in the cloud? So without going into too much detail about our networking infrastructure, we have what I would consider is a business-grade, commercially available secondary internet connection connected to our firewall. If it detects that the primary connection is down, it will automatically fail over to the secondary connection. And these cloud systems that we have, we talked previously how there's they're defined as software as a service. They're designed to be in the cloud and work off of a standard internet connection. And so they can work with a lower speed, lower latency type connection, such as a business grade commercially available internet connection. 17, we're almost there. Have we considered contracting with Snohomish County for GIS services? So I know that we've had partnerships with both Snohomish County and King County as they relate to GIS for flyovers, for imaging and that sort of thing, and I know they've been very helpful when we've had GIS-related questions in general, but I don't know if we've gotten to that step of actually doing any contracting with them for GIS, so I honestly don't know the answer to that question. 18. You said that we have 14 virtual servers. Do we really need that many? Why does printing on a local printer need an entire server? Would consolidating some of the servers reduce our costs? Are the costs in the cloud higher because we're running 14 servers? So there's several reasons why we're running the number of servers that we're running. One of them is for redundancy. Some you need to have more than one in case one fails. Because if it does, it would take down significant portions of the operations. Some of them are system requirement conflicts. Two pieces of software just don't play nice together, and so they need to be on their own. Some software vendors say, if you're going to run our software, we will not support it if it's running alongside anything else. And so if they find out that you're doing that, they will not support you anymore. Some of it is functional conflict, just separating departments. For patching purposes, if you're going to update one server, you don't want to take down a whole entire department. And then to answer the other question, yes, the more servers that we run in the cloud, the higher the cost goes up. That's one of the negatives with it. The more servers we run here as well, it does have some incremental costs as well. I would also like to point out here that even if we were to run zero servers in the cloud, and we just had a connection to the cloud, that it would cost us $80,000. That's more than the cost of the Nutanix server. So even if we were to reduce all our servers down to zero or one, we would still be paying $80,000 just for the connection to the cloud, which the Nutanix servers are, you know, $65,000 or whatever it was. So I don't think reducing our server footprint is going to solve the problem of should we go to the cloud or not. Couple more things on this redundancy, system requirements, conflicts. I think I duplicated a couple things here, but I did want to include this graph on here to show several of these servers have things combined. So, Virtual Server 5, our city file and print server. So we've combined where we can file and printing services. Virtual Server 3, the same thing on the police side, file and print. On the left here, Virtual Server 2, Help Desk and Monitoring. These are two separate services that I was able to combine into one. Our Auditing and Remote Authentication Server, those are combined, two separate services combined into one. Where we can provide our Updates Server and Antivirus, those are combined into one. So anywhere where I've been able to, I've taken two separate services that don't have anything to do with each other and combined them into one server instead of running, I mean, that's four servers there. Three or four servers there that we've been able to reduce down to limit our footprint. So 19, can we see your written 5-year strategic plan for IT needs? where are you taking the city over the next 5 years, and how do these purchases fit with that plan? With all this new equipment, are you anticipating another IT employee? So I emailed out the IT work plan that we have. I'll admit that it needs some more work. It's been a while since I've updated it, but it shows projects that we've worked on over the last few years and some projects that we're working on the next few years. And one thing that we've been working on through the various departments is to try and create more of a citywide equipment replacement plan, because we've been working through different departments, Public Works and IT as well, where we need to have a little bit more forward thinking about how we plan for replacing aging equipment rather than waiting until it gets too old and then trying to figure out where we come up with the money to replace the really old equipment. And so that's not just an IT issue. That's kind of encompasses all departments. So with this new equipment, are you anticipating another IT employee? Not related to this equipment, no. If anything, this equipment would help to reduce employees, because it would help me to sleep at night to know that the servers are more redundant and more fault tolerant, and not have to worry about them as much. I think that we're a little short-staffed in IT if we're bringing up the question with our size and with the workload, but the servers don't have any impact on that. Question 20, when does the current firewall need to be replaced, and how much will that cost? How much is the licensing on the firewall? So the current firewall was purchased a few years ago. It still has several more years before the end of life. I would say, it's hard to tell, pricing into the future several years, but based on what it costs us to purchase initially, I would say the estimated replacement cost around $8,000. That's what it cost us several years ago. The annual cost for licensing, support, and warranty on it ongoing is about $1,700. That's what we pay. It covers a slew of services that the firewall provides to protect the city from the internet. So that's the last question. The only other thing that I would add is, we've gone through this several times. We have a quote from the vendor that they prepared for us a few weeks ago, actually a couple months ago now. They have their end of quarter that's coming at the end of July, and they start a new quarter in August. And so they reset their pricing in August, and so they've given us their end of quarter pricing. And so there's a good possibility that their beginning of quarter pricing will not be as good as their end of quarter pricing, and they've also added in some extra things such as free on-site installation that's worth several thousand dollars, around $7,500. And so I had a vacation scheduled coming up, and so I will not be here to answer questions at the July 23rd council meeting. And so I just wanted to make you guys aware of the timeline. So I'll answer any other questions if you have follow-up on these ones or anything else unrelated.
Thank you. Mike?
Thanks, James. Fantastic job answering a whole bunch of extra questions. I think you've made a good decision here. I think it makes a lot of sense. I'd love to see us move forward to a point where we're more redundant and resilient than we were in the past. And notwithstanding the pricing potentially changing on us and the good deal we've got on installation, I'd like to make a motion to authorize the city manager to issue a purchase order to CDWG in the amount of not to exceed $50,298.50, providing for a three-node Nutanix server cluster, including that includes 3 years of service agreement and installation.
So there's no second.
I'd like to ask, there's no second. This is incredibly good work. This is in our budget. It's in our capital plan. Why are we not willing to move forward on this? What's going on? Who's hiding what?
Nobody's hiding anything. I got 11 megabytes of information today, and he did a good job answering the questions, and I want to look at the rest of the information. If everything is fine, I'm ready to move forward on the 25th. But out of respect for all the work that was done, I want a chance to look at it. And if I have any questions, I can ask him before he leaves. This is not holding things up. This is just doing my homework. And maybe not everybody wants to do this, do the same thing. I spent the last week, I am more, I've done so much work on this to get up to speed, and I just want to read the rest of the information. So if the rest of the council wants to move forward, that's fine. But I need to review the information. And I will get the questions in ahead of time, so if I have any problems, you know, it's completely my fault that this got in Sunday night. So I will get it done and get it to him if I have any questions. And but just for tonight's purposes, I need to read the work that he did. So that's speaking only for myself.
Our deadline, July 31st?
I know that's when the quote expires. They had asked me to get it to them by, I believe it was July 15th was when they had wanted to have it in.
When do you leave on vacation?
July 23rd is when I leave to go on my vacation.
So if I don't have any other questions, if anyone else has any questions, can we make a commitment to get him in by a certain date so he has sufficient time to respond to them?
Absolutely. And if I don't, then we'll just have to move. If I, for some reason I have questions and I don't know yet, then we'll just have to move forward because I didn't get my homework done. But I am committed to studying this and making the right decision. And by the way, just in case you think I love the cloud, we went to the cloud, all at the cloud and at the county or at my day job. It slows everything down. I mean, I went through 100 pictures today and it was like, ah! So, Councilmember Bond.
Thank you, Mayor. I like James. I trust James. And I like the information. But I'll use an example to share where I'm struggling. About 10 years ago, apparently, my recollection is not that great, but I do recall we need to buy these crosswalk things. They're solar powered. Councilmember Bond, you have a question? Yeah, we've got lousy winters around here. Oh, no. Solar power's fine. It'll work. It'll be great. What about the trees? Oh, Councilmember whoever it was. Yeah, no, don't worry about the trees. We trimmed the trees. It's all great. Well, now, we shouldn't have bought those. We got lousy sun in the winter. We got trees everywhere. I don't know what kind of bunch of idiots bought those 10 years ago. That technology is not changing nearly as fast as this. That's what's scaring me. I just don't want to write a $100,000 or whatever check or and then go, wow, we kind of went a little left when we could have went right. Maybe this is absolutely the best thing given what we have, what we're trying to do with the resources we have right now. But that's my concern. Is it really the best? Is it the best, or in a few years from now, are we going to be going, yeah, the solar power is not the thing. We need to go a different direction. That's all I'm struggling with. And this technology is just so rapidly changing. And if you talk to 4 or 5 experts, you're going to have 4 or 5 opinions of, and they'll all be different as to the best solution to this type of thing. There are some other ideas out there, and I'm not a tech guy, so I'm just listening and I'm processing, and I mean, I don't know. But that's my fear, that the technology is changing fast and we'll invest a lot of money and it won't be money well spent in a couple years. But if the majority of you don't share that concern or you believe, I have enough faith in James. I could go forward on this and just trust that we're doing the right thing. This is way out of my skill set. So I'm going to lean on the rest of you guys a lot more to help me get to the right place here. I'm not against seconding you, Mike. I just was struggling with it and trying to process it all.
Okay, John, you got anything?
I do. Thank you. Interesting. I was actually quite surprised that nobody seconded. Let me state my own opinion first. My opinion is I've listened to all of the data. I am familiar with working with the cloud, with larger corporations, and doing our own dedicated servers when that made sense with smaller companies. I do think in our case, in our size, based on the questions that James has answered for us, I am very confident with moving ahead with a dedicated server-based program as opposed to working with the cloud. Why I wanted to wait to find out why somebody was seconding it, and if it would allow some of the council members some extra time to digest this information, and it does not put us at risk of losing this bid. I second that. Does not put us at risk of losing the bid. Now, I'm supportive of that. But if we have to make a decision tonight, and because we might lose the bid, then I would support making a decision tonight, and I would be in favor of dedicated servers. I've worked with both, and I think given our situation, given the longevity of both, I think we won't be hurt by the hardware solution and dedicated server. I don't feel we're going to be financially hurt by that, but I do think we're going to be overbuying what we don't need, and I have been part of overbuying on technology. It will be different 3 years from now. We will need a different solution. It may be the cloud. It may be something else. Cloud may be outdated. Good Lord, I doubt it, but it could happen the way technology changes. Given today's information available to us, I think fiscally it is our best decision to move ahead with the dedicated servers. But if some of the council members would like that extra time to the 23rd, meeting on the 23rd, and I couldn't quite hear everything, if it doesn't hurt us, doesn't put our bid at risk, I'm okay with waiting, but if it does put the bid at risk, then I would prefer we make a decision tonight. So my one question is, does it put the bid at risk? I couldn't quite hear that.
If you could let me double check on it and let you know later, I will double check what their deadline was. I believe what they told me was they needed an answer by July 15th is what they told me, but I want to make sure I give you accurate information.
Can you give us that information tonight?
Yes. I just need to check my email.
I think that'd be worth it, because if we could allow the mayor and the other council members that time to digest and doesn't put us at risk, I don't see a problem with that. I'd rather we were more unanimous and comfortable with the decision. But given a risk, I would suggest strongly that we do pursue the solution of a dedicated server. Would be my recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Stephanie?
I have a question. So if you are going to be gone the week of the 23rd,
mm-hmm.
And we're not here next week, so and we if we put this off to making a decision that night, mm-hmm. you're on vacation.
Correct.
Who is is there someone that's going to be able to actually implement this by the end of the month if they needed to have our answer by the end of the month?
I would have to work from vacation to implement it. Somebody would have to contact me from vacation, and I would have to do it while I'm on vacation to implement it, to execute it.
Can't just leave the paperwork for us to sign?
Okay, and that's what I wanted to know.
I could coordinate it and try and work it out.
I mean, it's just paperwork. You're authorizing the city manager to sign the contract. You have the contract. I just need, you sent me 11 megabytes. I have a day job. I just need a little more time to look at it. But if everybody else doesn't want to look at it or wants to move forward, that's fine. This is a commodity. There'll be a quarter end, another one later this year. But I believe we can get this done on the 25th, have the contract ready for the city manager to sign. So, Brian.
Can you speak to Councilmember Bond's comment about the change in technology? Is there a shorter option for us that would be less expensive than what we're looking at now?
So this was a three-year proposal. I don't think it's – I like your analogy, but I don't think it's quite a long-term solution as a crosswalk signal. It's a three-year commitment to this. I think it has the potential to last us much longer than that. But it's only a three-year commitment.
Is that the minimum commitment?
I think we could potentially ask them for like a one-year support agreement, but I don't think the price would drop that much because they usually bundle that in. It's just part of the deal, and so I don't think the price would drop significantly. We're buying the hardware at the initial purchase, and so I don't think the price would change significantly. It might go down a couple $1,000. because that's what they try to include as part of the deal. That's where they have a lot more flexibility on the pricing, is the support agreement and not on the hardware.
We'd be paying a little more for the ability to get out sooner if we're concerned about changing technology.
Yeah, and I think that would be, I mean, I realize that it's a sunk cost, but I think it would be throwing away good hardware, right? It would be like buying a brand new car and then selling it after a year, right? Your value would drop significantly in that first year, and you would lose a lot of money by selling it after 6 months or a year, I guess. You would lose a ton of value in your initial purchase.
Well, help me understand. We're buying the hardware with a 3-year service contract, right?
Yes.
If a shorter term, we'd be buying the hardware with a shorter term contract. They would probably charge us more for that shorter term contract. Am I understanding that correctly?
It's $54.40 per year.
Do you have the quote with you? Yeah.
It's $54.40 per year for the 3-year.
$5,440?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you take a year off of that, drops by $5,000.
Yeah, it's going to drop the price by about $5,000, I think.
Consequential.
So it seems that this is – so if we do nothing, what's our risk?
So if we do nothing, we have one server that's reaching end of life later this year, and it's not like we can buy a server a week before
right. And
we migrate everything. I need time to migrate the server.
You say it's reaching end of life. Be very clear. Tell me exactly what that means.
Yeah, so what that means is it's no longer under warranty with the manufacturer. If a component fails, we cannot get a replacement part quickly. We would have to go try and buy one on the open market. That would take time, bring it in for replacement, and so there would be significant downtime to the system. Could we try and extend the warranty on it again? We could, but because of the age of the system, the older the system gets, the higher the extended warranty cost goes up on it. And so it becomes less and less economical to extend the warranty on a server that's already 5 years old. And because of the other reasons to upgrade.
What are the likely components that might fail? Give me an example of one that would be a costly one that would fail.
A power supply would go out in it, take the whole entire system down.
How much would that cost? Ballpark. I won't hold you to it. Just throw me a close number.
$500 to $1,000.
Okay. So what if we ordered 3 power supplies and set them over here? Now another piece, a hard drive or memory or something.
Motherboard. Yeah.
I mean, if we took $10,000 and just bought a stack of replacement parts and said, we're going to sit over here, when something breaks, we're going to spring into action, we're going to swap it out ourselves. Is that something you could do or someone else would have to do? I'm going somewhere with this, so just bear with me.
We could buy, those are called cold spares. You do that sometimes for other types of equipment. You could buy cold spares and have them on the shelf. What that doesn't help you with is the downtime that it could occur. That would occur when that happens.
How much downtime are we talking about?
Depending on the component that fails.
The worst one.
Couple weeks.
Motherboard's the worst one, maybe? Sounds bad. I don't think I'd want to lose my motherboard. I just lost my fatherboard. Don't want to lose my motherboard. But I'm bunked. All right. Just lighten it up. Okay. So a couple weeks could be pretty devastating.
Yeah.
So we go to this system. Is there any scenario where we are down a couple weeks, the crisis of some sort? Does going to this say you'll never have to worry about being down for a couple weeks?
You never say never. Nobody guarantees anything, but that is the whole purpose of doing this, is that it has the built-in redundancy, fault tolerance, and failover capabilities that when a critical component fails, it automatically fails over to one of the other two redundant systems. So that's why there's 3 servers in there. You could literally pull out a whole entire server. You lose the motherboard. You lose the RAM. You lose the hard drives. You lose all that stuff, and all the data is automatically on the other servers. It recovers all that stuff. That's the point of the whole system.
Okay. So this buys us 3 years. It significantly reduces the likelihood that we would have a catastrophic failure. The other options that are available are much more expensive.
and could in 3 years come down, could go up, but technology seems to be coming down. Go buy a TV if you haven't bought one lately. So I'm willing to hear the arguments against it, but I'm, in my non-tech mind, I'm seeing some merit in going this path.
Mike?
Yeah, thanks. I think you hit on it. There's three choices here. One of them is the do-nothing choice, which you just explored. And so we have been going along with the do-nothing, making James lose some sleep. We should all be losing some sleep because we are in danger of something going bad. And we've got aging hardware. Yes, we probably could fix it, but being down for a week would be pretty devastating, not just for his health, but for all the people here who aren't getting work done. So we're making a decision. Do we want to leave the system the way it is where we have no redundancy, so we have no resilience to a failure of some sort? If we make the decision we want to change, then he's given us two options. For $50,000 for hardware plus some other stuff, $65,000, you can have our own thing here that is indeed technology is changing, but we get the problem solved for about that, or we go to the cloud. And the cloud right now is just expensive for an agency our size. So between the Nutanix and the cloud, fiscally, the best thing to do for 3 years is to go with our own server. Now, 3 years from now, that might flip, but by 3 years from now, we'll already have money in our pocket because we didn't go with the cloud now. The cloud is two or three times as expensive. So if we want to go with the cloud now, we can, but we're going to flush $90,000 more over the next 3 years than if we went with the Nutanix. And so from a financial standpoint, this is the right solution if we made the first decision that we want to have redundancy and resilience.
Do
we want to have redundancy and resilience? Then we go with the Mark Bond, let's have some cold spares, and buy him a comfort blanket.
And room to grow. We need room. We need the room to grow where we have a server that's expiring.
One of the things I struggled with, Mike, and just to, I don't know if it's going to answer it, but show you where my head's at a little bit, is do all roads lead us to the cloud at some point anyway? And I guess kind of Mark touched on it with technology. That's kind of where I'm struggling. Are we buying something that's just kind of, you know, not evolving with what's going on in the rest of the world here? That's kind of the information that I've gleaned from this.
Well, I think the cloud is great for applications. The presentation last week, we have 60% of our applications in the cloud. I spoke with Snohomish County last week, and you mentioned it last week as well. They had several of their cloud services down. The cloud is not all that it's cracked up to be. The wave of the future that everybody always talks about, sometimes you turn around two or three years later, and it's not all that it was cracked up to be. They had their voicemail in the cloud on July 2nd was down, and they couldn't check their voicemail. They had email issues on July 2nd that was down. Like I mentioned, they had their SharePoint where they store a bunch of their files on July 3rd. It was down most of the day. So I would caution, just because it's the latest and greatest thing does not mean it is the greatest thing. It's just the latest thing. And Nutanix Hyperconverged is not old technology. It is a different way of slicing bread, and it's the right fit for us. And I don't think you should think just because we're not going to the cloud that we're staying behind the times. You know, we got our email in the cloud, and we got all those other things in the cloud that I mentioned before. Just because we're not putting our servers in the cloud is we're not behind the times. What we are implementing is what City of Seattle is implementing, Tukwila, Marysville, Arlington, City of Redmond in the heart of Microsoft. It's what they're running all their stuff on. This is not old technology or behind the times. It's, in many respects, in my opinion, obviously, a better way of doing things. It's a more cost-effective way of doing things for us. And so I don't think you should think that we're going to regret this decision, especially when it's a short-term, in the big picture, a short-term commitment.
Hey, Councilmember Holzklaw, then.
Let me take Councilmember Cavalieri's question one step further. Assume he's right that 3 years from now, everyone's in the cloud. Is there any, sitting here today in July of 2019, is there any financial advantage to switching now as opposed to 3 years from now?
There's no financial advantage. Like I mentioned, just the connection to the cloud is $80,000. That is more than buying the Nutanix server. So even if you told me today, James, we don't like your recommendation, I want you to go to the cloud, I'm going to turn around and say, okay, the first thing we need is the connection. And we're going to start paying money for the connection, and that's going to cost more than the Nutanix servers themselves. I don't see any way you could slice it that it would save us money.
Naked with no protection.
Unless we don't do anything.
Stephanie, I think I personally have went a 180 from being really excited and wanting to know more about the cloud to coming back around to a different perspective here. I've just been doing some research, and I did ask James, thank you for answering my question about ransomware. And I personally am a little nervous about having all of our things out in the cloud now. I'd rather actually have control of it. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of went all the way around and feel a little better if everything's not out on the cloud where somebody could just take control of it and us not be able to get to it. So I just want to throw that out there that I realize that the cloud seems to be the future, and maybe me wanting to hold on to the data sounds outdated, but I am starting to feel like it might be safer to have the data here in our own server as opposed to the cloud. So that's just what I'm kind of thinking right now.
Yeah, I haven't said that I'm opposed to this, and I haven't said that I'm totally in favor because I haven't been able to do the homework. So I got 11 megabytes of information today that I asked you, for which I am very grateful. I'm not opposed. I'm not against. I'm just not fully informed. And that's all I'm saying. So I would be willing to move on the 25th after I have a chance to digest it. But if everybody wants to move forward, that's up to them. You know, we can vote that way. But I'm not saying that I'm opposed. I'm saying I need to finish the homework. So, and that's just me. Mike.
So we've talked about this the week that Mayor and I weren't here, but I listened to the tape. We talked about it last week. We talked about a lot tonight, got a lot of answers. And so I'm going to renew my motion to authorize the city manager to issue a purchase order to CDWG in the amount not to exceed $50,298.50, providing for a three-node Nutanix server cluster, including 3 years of service agreement and installation. And looking for a second.
I'll second.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a motion and a second.
My motion?
Yes.
I think, you know, there's times when we don't feel like we're prepared, and I guess that happens. You know, we all have other lives, as you point out, and a lot of information. But I feel like we've been through this for many weeks here. We've had an opportunity. I think it's prudent to move forward with this. I do not want to lose the opportunity for us to take advantage of this quote. I don't think there is anything that would say there is a better solution unless we want to go with nothing. So if we vote against this tonight, that's okay. Then we're voting for nothing, or we're voting for revisiting this in a couple of weeks. But I don't think the cloud is going to be the answer. So I would like to see us support this and move on. Thanks.
Councilmember Bond.
Thank you, Mayor. Yeah, I hope my fellow council members will support this as well. And this is the reason. None of us here are gifted or really knowledgeable in this arena, so it's going to require a certain amount of faith in staff on this one. It's just the bottom line. And I've not had any reason not to trust James. I appreciate the presentation and your hard work. The only way we save money, as I see it in my non-tech mind, is the do-nothing approach. We could maybe spend $5,000 or $6,000, do a little war chest of some spare parts, and roll the dice. And we might do just fine doing that, but we might not. And so the safer route to ensure that our city can provide the essential services they're providing, specifically thinking of the job the police department does and their fairly significant shift towards leaning heavily on technology and computers, I think this is the cost-effective and the smart play at this time. And we're asking for a three-year window. We can evaluate it along the way, but it's not. We're not trying to shoot out 10, 15 years. If we were, I'd be more cautious here, but it's a reasonable. And I will say this, as a video gamer, a game player, bought a $4,000 computer to run my little thing at home so I can throw bullets and grenades at my enemies. So $50,000 to run a city compared to $4,000 for me to get email and throw video graphic grenades is probably not that terrible in the big picture of things. So I hope you'll consider us. I will support this, and I hope you'll consider supporting it with me.
Hey, anybody else? So we have John, did you have anything else to add?
You know, I was sitting here deciding if I wanted to say anything or not, but I think it's important to make this comment before we take the vote. After listening to the data that was presented and all the questions that James has answered, I personally do not believe that you can second guess what technology will do. The cloud may or may not be the answer. There may be a different answer 3 years from now. Nobody even knows about today that has replaced the cloud that's far better than the cloud was. Given our needs, given our current understanding of technology, given the current cost, I think confidently in my heart the best solution is to go with the dedicated servers and not pursue the cloud at this time.
Okay. Anybody else? We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
From the phone.
Right. Opposed?
I'll oppose it.
Nay. So passes 5-2. Now we're on to our next item is Snohomish County Supplemental Work Order for On-Call Backup Emergency IT Services. City Manager?
Thank you, Mayor. As Mr. Bush referenced earlier, he's planning on going on well-earned vacation at the end of the month. It's my understanding that in the past what the city of Mill Creek has done is worked with Snow 911 and actually its predecessor, the Snowcom and Snowpack, to offer redundant services for the city. They have indicated to James that they are no longer interested in offering that redundancy, and so we have pursued a supplemental work order with Snohomish County, who has offered to provide us with emergency backup service. And James is going to summarize that for us, and we just wanted to ask council for their approval to enter into this agreement with Snohomish County.
Yeah, so I just have a couple comments about this, and then I'll answer any questions that you may have. So last week, Councilmember Cavalera, you had asked about partnerships with Snohomish County, and I had to bite my tongue a little bit because this was in the works, but quite not fully baked yet. But this is an agreement that I was working on with Snohomish County to have them provide the backup IT services in my absence, as mentioned in the agenda summary, at a conference or on vacation or otherwise. And so this is a pretty straightforward agreement for them to provide that backup service in my absence. And so if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them for you.
Okay. Any discussion? Do we have a motion?
Sure, I'd be happy to make a motion to authorize the city manager to sign Snohomish County Supplemental Work Order SW0-03-19-CO.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Now we're up to our study session on the East Gateway Urban Village Spine Road West Connection Professional Services Contract. City Manager?
Thank you, Mayor. Ms. Gina Hortalos has prepared a slideshow, or PowerPoint presentation, to bring us all up to speed as where we're at in this discussion. I understand there are some outstanding questions as it relates to potential eminent domain or other possible proceedings that might be an outgrowth of this, and Ms. Hortalos is prepared to address those as well.
Thanks, Michael. Good evening, Council. So the agenda, just for clarification, a couple of logistics. The agenda summary was prepared with a motion. However, this is a study session. And also the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation slides are in your council folders. So I'll start off with, this is regarding the EGOV, the East Gateway Urban Village Spine Road West Connection Phase 1, and it's regarding professional services. And I'll provide some background on the project, cover the consultant contract, and then identify next steps. As far as project background, I'll start off with this picture. This picture is taken from 44th Avenue Southeast, and it shows signs out there identifying the future road connection. You can see on the screen, on the right side of the screen, the church, the Lutheran church, just for general orientation. And this other aerial photo shows the two parcels in discussion, but I'll actually walk very slowly through this aerial photo and talk about what is phase one, what is phase two, et cetera. So last year, as we were preparing the CIP, we talked about dividing the Spine Road. It's a large project. It will be costly to build this road. It's in our comprehensive plan. It has been planned by the City of Mill Creek for quite a few years. That's my understanding. And so in order to be able to achieve a project of this size, we decided to phase it, and we called phase one the brown section here on the screen, which goes from 39th Avenue Southeast to 44th Avenue Southeast. The previous slide where I had the pictures of the roadway extension signs were taken right here at this location on 44th. So that's phase one. And phase two, which is not in the CIP, is the extension that takes Spine Road to Seattle Hill Road. Within phase one, I'll start on the west side. We have the farm, the development, private development that was discussed earlier this year. And the developer will be building that portion of the Spine Road.
Yeah, can I ask a question on that map? I just want to make sure so we don't start chasing our tail again as we have when we've discussed this before. That map reflects the conceptual plan from the comp plan 10 years ago. It does not reflect where the Spine Road is going to be built with the farm, and it does not reflect where the Spine Road was built with regard to the vintage, correct?
Correct. It's a conceptual map prepared by Reed Middleton several years ago.
Yeah, I would ask to facilitate our discussions when we look at this again that we stop using that map, because I think that map causes a lot of confusion, because that's not what is going to happen with the Spine Road if we decided to move forward.
We can work on developing an updated map.
Thank you.
So for conceptual purposes and discussion purposes, Spine Road through the farm is planned to be built by the developer. In the vintage, it has already been built, and I'll have some photos about that. Then here in red is the first parcel in discussion. It's the Rim Kim parcel. Currently, it's a beauty salon closer to 132nd and a home south of that. East of that is the Gateway building. This particular parcel has dedicated the right-of-way for the future roadway to the city of Mill Creek, so we have a dedication. I will say it's conceptual, yes. And it is a dated map, so I would not consider this surveyed information or actual information. It's just conceptual. That's what we have thus far.
The exception of polygon, the portion on the polygon development, I believe, does reflect what is actually built from this aerial. Is that not an aerial photo?
I will need
photo
to confirm that. It has not been.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, under my watch, it has not been surveyed, so I cannot confirm that. And the last parcel within the phase one, again, the brown section, is the Advent Church. And for that parcel, we do not have any dedication. So again, for the city to be able to move forward with the eventual construction of Spine Road, there are two parcels for which we need right-of-way. And those two, again, are shown in red in this picture.
Is at least that part of this conceptual design correct with the spine road?
Meaning that those are the only two parcels?
No, yeah, and is it actually there in that specific location?
This is a conceptual map, so it's not the specific location, and that's part of the professional services contract that we have. We need to survey what has been built and make sure that whatever we acquire is actually in the location that it needs to be.
Okay, and is this portion of the spine road you're expecting that Mill Creek will pay for it?
So there's multiple ways we can go about that. Right now, as we have it in the CIP, is for right-of-way acquisition. Right now, there is no allocated or dedicated or identified funding for design or construction. So why build a spine road? And I think always going back to the purpose and need and why is it even needed or what value does it add is important. And there are three main reasons, and again, this has been in our comprehensive plan, and I wanted to just update why we're looking at Spine Road. And so safety, mobility, and connectivity. Safety, with Spine Road, we will have, once it's built, connection in the eGov and have two fully signalized accesses within the eGov, one at 39th and one at 44th. Also, there'll be improved mobility. So, for instance, right now, if I visit the Gateway facility quite often and realize that to make a left out of there, it is difficult, depending on the time of the day. So you need to wait sometimes in order to be able to enter or exit into any of those properties on the south side of 132nd. So with the Spine Road, there will be a decrease in wait times to access SR-96. And then connectivity, so vehicular and pedestrian access within the eGov, which is a commercial residential area. Now, as far as the project itself, again, we are just talking about phase one, which is located between 39th Avenue Southeast and 44th Avenue. And for this project, we're only talking about right-of-way. It usually, for a project of this nature, it takes years to build because first you need to have the land, you have to have the land use rights, and then you have to have the funding to design and build. So this is not something that I envision happening within a year or so, even if we're aggressive in pursuing funding. But in order to pursue funding to eventually build it, we need to start off with acquiring the right-of-way. Now, as far some of the questions that have come up had to be addressed in the scope of services with the consultant. So we know that Spine Road has been built thus far and incrementally. So we have Vintage that built it, and it is different, not necessarily matching that Reed Middleton conceptual map that was developed multiple years ago. So one of the first things is identifying what it is that we need to look at the two parcels for the future right-of-way. And also, we know that on the south end, towards the south part of the parcel of the Lutheran Church, there is a pond, and I have some photos. We need to look at drainage within the eGov, because again, it has been built in different developments, and we want to make sure that by building the roadway eventually, we're not causing any drainage problems. So we have to look at that, we have to study it. And then also, as part of the eGov, we have a pedestrian easement on the very south end of each of these parcels. And so in the consultant's scope of services that is included in the package, you'll see that all these three items are identified. We'll be touching all of these three.
Is that on the one of the scale maps, you have the Dunn roadway estimated cost in there as well? Are you including that in this here?
Phase two.
Attachment nine.
Oh, yes. So that is phase two. That's the connection to Seattle Hill Road. Thank you.
Okay.
And it's not included in the scope of services. This is only limited to phase one.
Thank you.
So this is... Yes, Council Member Steckler?
I have just a couple of questions to clarify, too, while we're going through this. The cost to gain the... right away is not in any of these numbers, correct?
The cost, correct. The contract that is included in this package is only for professional services. It does not include acquisition costs.
Do we have any estimates on that?
We do, and we went through that exercise when we put together the CAP. And for right away, for phase one, we've estimated the total cost at $500,000.
Okay, so that, and that's in the six, I don't know if my CIP with me, but it, that was a $6 million line item, correct, for phase one?
So the design and construction is in the millions. The right away acquisition is not. At least we don't anticipate it.
No, the right away you have in the CIP at $500,000. And don't you have a construction budget of $6 million, correct?
We have a construction estimate of about $6 million.
We have a WAG, I would call it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In capital letters.
Okay. The number you put in the budget to pay for this is $6 million. How about that? Is that more accurate?
No.
So, Councilmember Steckler, we have not budgeted $6 million or $5 million, because that is associated with the construction of spine. The only thing that we have in the CIP is right-of-way acquisition.
You do not have in the CIP any kind of number for the construction of phase one. Is that correct?
Correct. It's not in the CIP. It's in the transportation improvement plan. In the TIP, that's where we've allocated our swag for the construction.
So the money is in the transportation improvement plan, not in the Spine Road Phase 1. Is that what you're saying?
The planning is in the TIP. The CIP is a document that is financially constrained, thank you, and that's where the budget is allocated, if you will, not in the construction and not in the TIP.
Another way to say it. Another way to say that, the CIP is the wish list, the TIP is what we're going to build.
The other way around.
Other way around, okay.
What was that?
The CIP is what we're actually planning and tied to the budget, the biennium budget. The TIP is our wish list.
Is your wish list, okay. So in the CIP, the CIP is your wish list, correct?
No.
The T with
transportation improvement.
Transportation, thank you.
The transportation improvement plan, the TIP is your wish list, okay.
Correct.
There's no money to build the spine road.
I find this amazingly difficult to get an answer on. We wanted to build a spine road in two phases. In phase one, I assume we have an estimate for it, but it seems to be a very, very difficult question to ask. Okay. So you do have $500,000 in there for the right of ways. You do have a number somewhere I've seen it, $6 million, somewhere, to build phase one. Okay. That's what I wanted to clarify. And that those costs have not been revised based upon the developer's agreement to pay for the or cover the cost of the construction of phase one or to provide it to us after complete it once he's finished with the farm. We know he's paying for the farm 100%, and he's agreed to complete the other two sections for three sections for us. Up to 44. But your costs, have we addressed as to what those costs will be now?
So there's a lot of misunderstandings going on there, John. It's Mark. Sorry I'm not sitting next to you, bud. It's hard on the phone. You've got some stuff a bit turned around from the way I remember it. The council discussion in the past has been unanimous, pretty much, as I recall, that we're not building the spine road. We're going to let the developers build the spine road. We're going to let somebody else build the spine road. We're not going to spend the $6 to $10 million for the spine road. We had discussions about this, and if we've all changed our mind, then we can chime in and start expressing our change of opinion. But there's been no expressed will of this council to fund the spine road. So we're now having a discussion tonight on some of the benefits of completing this road if we want to, and sort of revisiting this, if I'm just, I don't want to speak for you, as to what our options might be now that some significant pieces of the spine road have been done, and what do we want to do? So that's kind of where we're at. So there is no really any $6 million anywhere it's just a placeholder or an idea of if we did this, this is kind of what it might cost kind of a thing. At least that's how I recall it. Correct me, Brian, if I got that wrong.
Before my time on the council. But during my time on the council, all I've heard is that we want to build this fine road, and we've had debates about who's going to pay for it, who's going to cover what about the right-of-way. I was aware of all those discussions. This is the first time I've heard somebody say that we may or may not want to pay for that ourselves. So if we're not 100% behind this fine road, why would we want to be investing money in the design of a spine road unless we know we want to build it? Doesn't it seem like we're kind of spending money to build something we may not want to pay for? We may want to try and get somebody else to pay for it?
We're not going to try. We're going to get it. They're going to develop it. The people that own the property and want to benefit from that property can build a road on their property, and we'll help them make it happen.
So the people that we're buying a right-of-way from, they are going to pay for the construction of the spine road on their property?
We're not necessarily buying the right-of-way. We're discussing that as an option, right?
Yes.
So
this is where it gets confusing, Mark.
I agree.
We're going to purchase the right-of-way on these two parcels, but we're not buying the parcels. We're just buying the right-of-way. And therefore, we're going to have to pay for putting the road in because they're not going to pay for that. We're not buying the land from them. We're buying the right-of-way from them.
I think it's looking a little forward, but you're probably right. The assumption is that we will end up footing the bill.
Well, let's.
I know, but if we're going to have this conversation,
I would like to recommend that we stop on this spine road project. Let's get this sucker in writing. Let's get clear on this thing because we have debate after debate after debate every time we bring it up, and then there's always new little pieces of information that. Maybe you guys have talked about it before I was there, but I think it'd be really nice to have this whole thing spelled out before we commit to any more design fees or anything else. What exactly are we trying to build? Do we agree we need to build it? How are we going to pay for it? Where's the money? Because otherwise we're going to have a debate every time somebody brings up a discussion about the spine road. There's a difference of opinion as to what exactly was agreed upon. Can we get a clear understanding on the spine road before we go ahead with anything else?
Councilmember Holzquad and Todd?
I think it's actually pretty clear. The only thing I recall there being agreement, unanimity on, is the decision we discussed several years ago to not go forward with Phase 2 through the Dunn property. We discussed that a couple
of years ago. I'm sorry, Brian, could you speak up? I'm sorry. Could you speak up?
Yes, sorry about that. The only thing I recall that there was consensus on was Phase 2, that was not something that we wanted to move forward with. With regard to the Phase 1 spine road, we have not made any decisions or commitments to move forward with building the road or how we would partner with someone or where we'd get the funding to build it, but we did include in our CIP money that is budgeted to acquire the right-of-way, so we have that option to look at it. And that's what staff is bringing to us tonight, is to take that step to look at acquiring that right-of-way, so then we have the right-of-way in hand and can have discussions with Ryan Pattison, like we did with the discussion on the development agreement about whether there might be some partnership or whether we could get grant funding or what other sources of funding there may be. So we can then make a decision as a council whether we want to move forward with building Phase 1 of the spine road. But we did budget in this CIP money to do exactly what staff has brought to us tonight.
Councilmember Todd.
Mayor Pro Tem Holzclaw said it pretty well, but I think that's we've all got to remember there is this first phase here that we've agreed to in the CIP was to figure out what the process would be for acquiring that right away, and securing that right away right now to make sure that it connects all the way through this property is we still think is fundamentally important, as Director Hortolosa just talked about it. That is not a commitment for us to go ahead and build it, but it does provide an opportunity for us to talk about partnering, and that's where we got a little bit confused. Was during the development agreement discussion, Mr. Patterson and his private company might be able to put the road in for a lot less than the city could, But his comment at the time was he would have liked to have done that, but he couldn't figure out how to get to secure the right-of-way on one of those parcels. And so this is the city moving forward with facilitating a piece that is instrumental for that road being built someday. I think this council has expressed a desire in having that road built someday. It is important to the economic viability of that entire project. I feel like we have at least some of it a commitment to try and make that happen, but I'm with others in feeling that we don't really want to fund this out of our own pocket. And so if we could do it by jointly agreeing to have somebody else develop it at a lower cost, future purchasers of those two parcels or those couple parcels are circled. Maybe there's a latecomers agreement. Maybe we get some grant funding. We still need to piece together the funding, and that's why it is not in our CIP. We've only put $500,000 for doing the study we're talking about tonight and hopefully having enough left over in the $500,000 to acquire those parcels, which I think is feasible. Thanks.
And we can't have those discussions with Ryan Patterson that we had back in January and February unless we have that right-of-way in hand. We don't have anything to talk to him about.
Exactly. Councilmember Cavallari.
Thanks, Mayor. And so everyone's clear, this what we're hearing today is just simply the consulting fees for the right-of-way purchase. But as far as I see it here, there's only three ways to really go about this, is to either broker a deal with the landowners, correct? Eminent domain, and just seize the property, as we all kind of knew was going to end up coming, or condemning it one way or the other. That is, and I know this is just for the original motion of the 120 grand. It's a lot of money to spend for a consulting group, but I sat in this same seat 3.5 months ago and said this was coming, where we're going to have to one way take these folks' land or run a road through it or whatever it is we plan on doing, but they're going to do it against their will at some point unless we got them to the table. People are going to say, hey, we're here now, don't worry about it. We're already here, just let's move forward. This is the reason I wanted this back to the council to have this discussion. This is why I wanted to have these negotiations. John's confusion is probably no different than any other citizen out there, because I don't think they're on board with dropping $10 million for a road that we potentially could have negotiated at some point, and I honestly think we could have. But I do agree that this conversation today is strictly for the $120,000, which at this point, without us hearing from the owners or someone reaching out, besides spending $120,000 on a consulting group, we don't know if they want to sell or not. So at this point, it's to essentially just take the land.
So, Councilmember Cavallari, there is an update to this. Last month, the property owners of this parcel right here, the Rimkin property, actually came to the building, the annex building where I work, to talk about their interest in selling.
Okay.
So that is an update that had not happened when we talked about this project in the past, because it just happened last month. And then I will add that as far as the other parcel, the church, we have a good relationship with the church. We have not approached them pending this professional services agreement about the acquisition, but we historically have had a good relationship with the church.
So I guess this goes back to even before the farm became a topic. So with knowing that all these components were going to have to take place to even get some sort of viable conveyance through there, why is the cart before the horse? You know, I hate to relive the farm, but here we are. You know, now we're looking to purchase land to put a road where they're already going to build an apartment building. I mean, that's exactly what we're doing. I know it's been planned, but it hasn't been funded.
So the apartment buildings, the farm, is this parcel here shown on the screen, and the developer is building that Spine Road, and we're not paying for that.
Right.
Spine at Vintage has been built, and we did not pay for that. So tonight's topic is related to right-of-way acquisition of the two parcels for which we don't have any land use rights.
Right.
And that's the Rimkin parcel. And, again, they approached the city last month. So Is eminent domain a possibility? It's always a possibility. Is it likely? If they're approaching us, it's not likely. They're a willing seller. Gateway parcel, they have dedicated to us. And then the church, again, we have historically had a good relationship. We have not reached out to them for the right-of-way acquisition. So that's, again, a review of where we're at.
Right. There's one road in, one road out when this thing's built if they don't agree to use their land, right?
One road in and one road out. 44th?
Yes.
So this has been built, and there's right. a signal, yes.
Right. So, I mean, there's really no, it's not enough, right? That one, otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation is what I'm saying.
That's correct.
Right? So I keep going back to this conversation or this agreement or these agreements should have been had a long time ago, and here we are in this position now trying to, I don't even know what to call it. Without sounding offensive, it's just really, I'm glad to hear about the RIMKEM property, and if we had such a great relationship with the church, why haven't they come forward before July 10th or 9th? Anyway, go ahead.
Councilmember Holtzclaw.
I need my bicycle helmet so I can bound my head against the wall. The city planned for this eGov 12 years ago for this concept. And the city has consistently implemented. When Mr. Pratt came to the city with his application to build the Gateway building, the city required him to dedicate his right-of-way for the future Spine Road. When Polygon came in with their application several years later to build their development on the East End, the city required him to build, or them to build, their portion of that road. The same happened with the Vintage when it came in, and the same happened again with the farm. So I'm confused of what we're, and then we made the decision in our budget last year to put the money in to look at acquiring the right-of-way to give us the option of figuring out what our options are for finishing the road. So we can't have the discussions with Mr. Patterson about partnering with him unless we have that right-of-way in hand. There's nothing to discuss, and it wasn't something to be negotiated as part of the farm. We would have ended up in court and probably losing. So I'm confused of where the confusion is here. It seems to me it's pretty straightforward where we're at and how we got here.
Okay.
You might disagree over that, but those votes were taken by the council over the last 12 years and were approved by the city consistent with its comp plan and zoning development regulations. So we can't go back and undo the decision on Polygon with that development agreement or the development agreement with the farm or with the Vintage. We are where we are. So do we go forward with looking at figuring out options for completing that road or do we not? It makes some sense to me that we wouldn't at least look at acquiring this right away so we could figure out how to complete this loop in this road for what we've been planning for 12 years. Makes no sense to me.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Well, first,
John, you're up next.
This isn't a look at acquiring the right of way. The road doesn't get complete without that. Simple as that, right? So that's where I'm at. That's where I'm at. This the road should have been handled a long time ago, and I've said that consistently. And could it have been negotiated with another project to do the work later? What a million things. You know, to say we are where we are later, after we already have to potentially, you know, eminent domain someone's land is, it's not fair. It's just not fair. I'm not saying to me, I'm saying to the landowners.
Okay, John?
Here's my question. And somebody said something about the cart before the horse. Step number one, do we want a spine road? Before we start making contractors build roads, before we start spending money on consultants, before we start buying right-of-ways, I get really concerned when I hear some council members saying, we're not even committed if we want to build this spine road. Before we spend another nickel, why don't we get our act together and determine if we want a spine road? I thought you guys had that discussion years ago, and this is a commitment. Obviously, it was not. So let's make sure we want spine road number one before we start spending any more money. We've already, I think we've pretty much committed ourselves to it, but because we've made some contracts that already built chunks of it. I want to make sure that's done, number one. Number two, I want to make sure we have the right-of-way. Then number three, I want to spend the money to go through the design phase of making sure exactly where it needs to go and how we're going to build rock. I don't want to spend $100,000 if we're going to have another debate a year from now over whether or not we should even build this fine road. Then don't spend the money now on what impact it's going to have. I do not support that. I support us saying yes or no, vote as the council. Do you want this fine road? You got chunks of it already built, so I think you do, but I'm hearing some people say, well, I'm not really sure I do. I'm very concerned about the process here. I think the fine road's number one.
City manager, do you have anything you want to add, or you're just sort of sitting there?
Actually, I don't at this point, but this is either something that the city has planned or it hasn't, and I really don't want to jump into this debate. I know that it predates me. I did listen to the audio when the vote came in originally as it related to the farm. I've just heard some new information from Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw as it relates to the planning that's been in place for 12 years, and yet what I'm hearing is that the land has not been acquired, and there are a number of outstanding issues for which a consultant is going to be planning that we don't necessarily have in the bank.
I guess I'll just throw in that conceptually, in my mind, when I see the spine road on the...
Motion to extend the meeting to up to 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? John, we're extending the meeting till 9. Are you a yes?
I'm sorry, I can't understand what's being said. Sorry.
We just extended the meeting to 9. Do you vote yes or no?
Say that again, please.
Do you agree to extend the meeting till 9?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Sorry.
So, passes unanimously.
So as your Director of Public Works and Development Services, my marching orders are the comprehensive plan and the CIP. And this project is in both of those documents. So in my mind, there's no doubt that the city is committed to moving forward with this project. If not, this project would not be in those documents. So that's where I stand as your director.
Okay, Councilmember Bond, and then Mike, you had your light on?
That was to extend, but we're fine.
Oh, okay, and then Councilmember Vignel.
So, John, I'm 100% in favor of finishing the road. We need to have the road done, and this acquisition is probably necessary to facilitate getting it moved forward and finding out who's going to pay for it. My objection is I just don't want us to pay the $6 to $10 million for the road. I want to work with somebody else that's going to benefit more from it if we can. If we can't, whatever. The road has to be completed. That's a given. I want the road done. Everybody here wants the road done. The question is, how are we going to pay for it, or who's going to pay for it?
And as staff member, I mean, we have done things to set us up for success, and I'll cover it later in the slide. So we are looking at options so that the city doesn't end up using local funds to pay for the design and the construction.
Okay, Councilmember Vignel.
I think the way I'm looking at this, okay, this was decided before I ever started on the council. This was in the CIP plan that we would like to have a spine road. I agree 100% with Councilmember Cavallari with his concerns and frustration during our farm discussion. But I look at this now, when I read through this last night, my understanding of what we're discussing on this contract today is so that you can go in and have someone survey and visually make us a concept of what this road needs to look like, where it needs to go, and if things need to be moved, such as the stormwater pond, and how that needs to look so that we know what land we need. So this is just that piece. And, in fact, it specifically says in here that there is no there's nothing in here for anything regarding eminent domains and condemnation assistance. So if we are going to have somebody else build the road, or if we're going to build the road, either way, we need to know where it needs to be and what it needs to look like, right? So to me, that's all you're asking tonight, is for us to let to approve this so that we can see what is needed, how much land we would need to buy as an easement, and what the road would need to look like based on what's there. All these other steps would come in under something different, right? So that's how I understand that. So I just want to make sure that my understanding is what this is, right?
Correct. So there is engineering components to the scope of services, as you described. So some of it is survey, because we need to know what has been built and where we need to acquire, precisely where we need to acquire. There's surface water drainage analysis that needs to be done in order for us to understand how the water flows, the surface water flows in the EGOV, and not create problems down the line. And then separately from that, and you see it in the package, is negotiation with the property owners. So that's what is included in the scope of services, negotiation with the property owners for purposes of these three elements that are on the screen. It does not include the amount of money that would be negotiated with those two property owners. That's a step two. We're not there yet.
Oh, and my other question was the money to do this. Where we had it written in the CIP, the $500,000 is mitigation fees, I think. So where is that exactly coming from, and was that what you were getting ready to discuss next?
I'm speaking a little out of term because that's finance. That's the finance domain, but it is my understanding that it's traffic mitigation fees.
And we also have the option of having a discussion about whether we dedicate the construction sales tax to some of this cost if we decided either these costs or if we decided to move forward with the acquisition of the property, or if somehow that factored into constructing the road if we got there down at some point down the road.
Hey, go ahead.
So this is a picture of Spine Road at Vintage that has been built, and a sign in the back, close-up of the sign, Future Road Extension. Another picture of future alignment of Spine Road. This parcel right here is the Rimkin parcel. There are some engineering challenges, if you will, as far as elevations. Nothing unsurmountable that retaining walls can't handle, but I just want to throw it out there. This is a picture of the approximate alignment of where Spine Road would be, and it's closer to the south end of the church property, and this is the pond that I'm referring to. And this is on the south parcel line. Here's the fence line of Vintage, and this is the location of where this 20-foot pedestrian easement, and this is the purpose of that pedestrian easement. Per a comprehensive plan, this pedestrian easement would run along the south end of the EGOV. And so since we're going to be approaching these two property owners, we thought it would be beneficial to the city to address that as well.
That picture's conceptual from the farm?
This is actually built. This is actually built.
So the farm would be continuing that to the west?
Correct. Yes. The topic of eminent domain, that is not necessarily something that we're anticipating at this time. It is possible. Again, I feel that it's relatively unlikely in the sense that the Rimkin property owners approached us, and we have a good working relationship with the church. Also talking about future funding, and what at staff level we've done is set us up for potential to just be even able to qualify for grant applications. In conversation with Greg Armstrong at TIB last year, one of the questions that he asked was, well, is the road even, you know, federally, does it have a federal functional classification? And at the time, the answer was no. So it has to be federally, it has to have a functional classification even to compete for state grants. So the road, and it's in your packet, has already been classified. So we have FHWA classification. So future design or construction can qualify for state or federal funds. That's at a very, something that staff can do, and we have already done, in order to be able to compete for state and
federal funds. There may be other development opportunities, or as we discussed, negotiations with Mr. Ryan Patterson. Those are separate from these two steps that we've taken in order to set us up for success as a city. Speaking of steps, as far as next steps, tonight's presentation, again, it's a study session. The plan at this time would be to come to council on July 23rd, recommending award of the professional services contract to Gray and Osborne. And in 2019, in the second half, we're in July, beginning the survey and appraisals at those two parcels that have been discussed. In early 2020, Gray and Osborne and their subconsultant would be doing negotiations and offers to the property owners, and mid-2020, closing the process. So that's the schedule that we have outlined. And be happy to answer any other questions.
Remind me how much traffic mitigation fees the farm is paying. Is that, if I recall correctly, $1.2 million is sticking in my head. Is that about right?
It's, yes, more than a million. I can't remember the exact number.
Okay. So I hope something we all keep in mind is, I keep hearing this number, $5 to $10 million for the cost of this road. First, that's a wag, a big ass wag. Second, you can take, going back to the original slide, if you could put that up, you can take out of the wag the $3 million on the west, because that is being constructed by the farm as part of their development. And you could take out the $6 million for phase two, because we're not doing that. So in my mind, we're somewhere between $1 and $5 million for the cost if we moved forward with building the road. We're at $1 to $5 million. We have $1.2 million in mitigation fees coming in this from this development that have to be used for projects that are on the tip, of which the construction of finishing phase one is one of those projects. And we have another $900,000 to $1,000,000 that we could use if we chose to dedicate the construction sales tax revenue from the farm towards traffic improvements in the eGov. So by my math, we start with the potential of having $2.2 million to build that road if we choose, and that's not taking into account whatever magic the staff is going to be able to work with finding the funding. But we need to do this step with this contract to position ourselves to find the partners, whether it be working with Mr. Patterson, whether it be working with TIB dollars or federal dollars or whatever we can find. We've got to take this small, make this small investment to get to that point, to leverage the dollars that we might have ourselves already or have coming in, and to find other sources of funds so we can hopefully, because I think we all share the same vision, idea. If we complete this road, we want to use it with as few dollars as Mill Creek dollars as possible.
Hey, anything else tonight? John, do you have anything else tonight?
Yes, I honestly, I guess I'm struggling with moving forward to do this assessment of the costs and challenges without first getting the letter of intent or agreement for right away from these property owners. If we start spending all this money before we have their approval for right away, then it's kind of like building a garage and then deciding, you know, if you want to buy the car to go in it or not, and how much it's going to cost you. It puts the negotiation in a little bit more in their favor than our favor. I think we should at least have a letter of intent that the easement is agreed upon, that they understand and they agree to an easement right, and then go ahead and spend the money to determine exactly how difficult it's going to be and what the cost would be and what we'd be willing to pay. And to me, that just seems to make more sense than doing all the research and spending a lot of money before we have agreements that they give us the easement right. That really puts the power in their court, and I don't think a really wise move. I wouldn't agree with that.
Okay, Councilmember Vignell.
Councilmember Steckler, I think the way I'm looking at this is that we don't know how much of an easement we need from each property owner to go to them to ask for until we do this study so that we know what the road needs to look like and what's needed. And then we can go to them with that information and ask them for exactly the amount of an easement we need. Otherwise, we have no idea what's asked for the easement. At least that's my understanding of what I read.
If I could respond to that, I did hear that before, Stephanie. What I want is a letter of intent that they do agree to an easement, that they agree that they are going to grant us an easement. But we have to do this study in order to determine exactly what it's going to be and therefore how much we would need and how much we'd be willing to pay. But a letter of intent tells us in good faith that they already are in agreement. And I think that's easy enough to get and a smart thing to get before you start spending all the money. I understand you want to do that to get the exact amount, but get a letter of intent first.
Is that how it works?
As far as my understanding is for our city right-of-way procedures, which have been approved by WSDOT, so we're covered if we get one federal dollar in the construction phase, that is not how it works.
I didn't think so.
Okay, well, we're going to have another discussion, John, on the 25th when you're back. So you're going to be here at the next council meeting, right?
Oh, yes.
Or the 23rd.
But we're voting tonight to approve just the
No, we're out. Not. This is just a study session.
Oh, I thought you had a motion to approve.
No motion to approve. Study session, and perhaps when you get back, you can sit down with the Public Works Director and... You know, it's really hard because you're listening on audio and the pictures aren't right. I mean, the map isn't. Anyway, you'll get a chance to look at everything.
Understood.
Okay. Are we done for this tonight? Okay. Moving on to the consent agenda. Approval of checks number 60511 through 60572 and ACH wire transfers in the amount of $488,439.96. Audit Committee, Council Members Vignell and Todd, any exceptions?
No exceptions.
No exceptions.
And payroll and benefit ACH payments in the amount of $221,525.12. Any exceptions?
No exceptions.
Exceptions.
Thank you. So do we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Reports? I'll just skip it tonight for the sake of time. Mark?
No report.
That's it.
Just real quick, Mayor. The Parks Board met and reviewed some of the Parks Tour results, and for those that don't know, that is essentially just kind of an assessment of what needs to be repaired, replaced within the city's parks. So just to kind of update a little bit, before councils presented with that list, as they customarily have been in the past, the idea is to create a rating system to prioritize the needs, you know, for safety, for security and whatnot ahead of time, so we know what it is we're buying and
John,
prioritize it.
Okay, John, I skipped you. Do you have any reports?
No report, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay. Councilman Vignell?
No report. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
I'll save most of it for 2 weeks from now, but the one thing I would like to bring up is Chris Collier, the Executive Director of the Affordable Housing Alliance of Snohomish County, is interested in talking with us. I don't know if the will of the council is to bring him in and have him talk with us first, or if you'd like me and the city manager and possibly Public Works Director and Tom Rogers to meet with him first. But he's interested in coming and talking to us about what they're up to and some of the housing issues that they're dealing with. Because there's a lot happening on the housing affordability. Department of Commerce came out with its report on housing memorandum of issues affecting housing availability and affordability. I think you heard reference before to the Ruckel House report that was coming out. This is volume 1 of 4 that just came out. There's a lot of light reading to come on with this issue, and Councilmember Vignall will be covering for me next week at the HART meeting when this is taken up further. So I don't know what the will is, if you like to hear from him, if you like the city manager and me to kind of meet with him first to have a discussion. I Yes, the only other thing I'd like to raise with the heart that I hope that you'll carry this message at the meeting next week is I know I spoke with County Council Member Nate Nearing, and there's some level of concern the direction the heart is heading, that is focusing on too much throwing money at the problem and not dealing with the supply issue, which I wholeheartedly agree. There's a great article in the New York Times last weekend that was analyzing some of the Democratic presidential candidates' housing policies, and it was lauding some of them for actually focusing on supply, because the point of the article was you can throw all the money, it's rent assistance and subsidies and that sort of thing. All that does is increase the demand. It makes more people able to afford housing and just drives up the demand even further. And if you don't do anything about the supply side of things, you're not solving the problem. You're just making it worse and just causing us to look at throwing more dollars at the problem. So I know that that's going to be one of the topics addressed at the meeting next week that I hope you'll carry forward. So that's what I had.
Okay, Mike?
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw kind of asked us a question. I would say, given that we have a fairly full agenda next time, and then we're off for August, would it be?
Well, why don't I meet with him, and then we can schedule a time maybe to bring him in to talk to us and give a brief presentation in September.
Yeah. September too late for the information he's got?
No.
I would say look forward to that, but have you work with the city manager in the meantime is fine with me. City manager and staff. I think Tom Rogers has been doing a lot of this stuff, so that'd be good.
Yeah, it has to work that way.
Okay.
Festival this weekend. There's probably staff stuff going on, but I'm going to mention from the standpoint of the Mill Creek Business Association, now the Mill Creek Chamber of Commerce. They reached out to me as recently as Saturday and had lots of slots open for help at their beer garden and at parking lot watching and some other stuff like that. So if anybody in the community would like to go do some shifts, I can get you in contact with Heidi Butts at the Mill Creek Chamber of Commerce, who's kind of always looking for help. And so I'm going to try to help out as much as I can. But if anybody's looking for something to do, rather than stand around at a city booth or a other booth, she could sure use some help. So thanks.
In fact, I'm checking IDs from 11 to 1:30 at the beer garden on, and I know how old everybody is here, so don't try.
But the rules are you still have to check them.
I will. I know. Absolutely.
Amazing. Mike, can you get me her contact information? Because I told her that I would volunteer, and she has not gotten back with me.
Okay.
So
I think it'd be okay if I took her information and put it out on. Why don't I give it to you or Gina? Can I give it to you, Gina, to get to the council? I'll
please
do that tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. City Manager, do we still need an executive session?
We do. I only expect it'll take maybe 20 minutes.
We're going to need to extend our meeting again.
Motion to extend the regular meeting until 9:30.
Okay.
Up to 9:30.
Regular meeting.
Then we have a motion and a second to extend the meeting to 9:30. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Up to 9:30.
Aye.
Okay. Passes unanimously. The council planning schedule's there. Did you have anything to add?
No, I do not, Your Honor.
Okay. With that, we will go into executive session for up to 9:30. Per RCW 42.
Yes. Staff, do we have a city booth, and is there something we should know about? Could you give us a quick before we do it?
We do have a city booth. We'd love for you all to stop by if it's convenient for you. We'll be running the booth all weekend, so from 11 to 6 on Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
We're also going to be there with the Police Foundation, and the police booth is right next to us. Fire is right across the way. You're welcome to come work it. We'd be happy to have you.
Yes, we'd be very grateful.
We just got general information on the city. We're not doing any surveys or anything this year.
Right.
Oh,
there's no surveys going on at the moment. We are talking a little bit about upcoming events as kind of our main focus. And we'll be talking maybe a little bit about ways to get in touch with us.
Well done. Okay. So with that, we are going to go into executive. What? Oh, okay, sorry, I was looking at the list here. Audience communication, going once, twice, John.
Very briefly, sorry. John Raymer, 831 148th Street, Southeast Mill Creek.
want to thank Councilman Steckler and Chief Egan for coming out on the Ralph Johnson the 2nd of July. I'm sure they reported back on it how great of a time it was. While out, we had an opportunity to speak to the captain, and he has extended the possibility of having a barbecue for the crew in the first 2 weeks of September. I'm only bringing it to your attention. I've already talked to the commander of AMVET's Post 2018 here in Mill Creek. They'll give some funds for purchasing of materials for that, and I believe the Kiwanis has also expressed some interest in doing that. Since it's going to be in the first 2 weeks of September, most likely, I know you guys are going to be gone for the month of August. It'll be a very short turn to invite you guys out. Just wanted you to be aware it's going to be a short notice event for you guys.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure I wanted it. Okay, I will. Okay, so now we're going to go into executive session at 8:55 p.m. per RCW 4230-110-1G performance of a public employee. No, we're going to go into the conference room, and this will be up to, we decided, 9:30. Right. Yes, we're going to pull him in because he can go, and we are action may or may not be taken. So with that, let's go into the conference room.
Yes.
Don't forget me.
You're
not.
Do we carry John in there? Do we have to recall him?
We have to recall him. It has to be unplugged.
Okay. Can you get him in there?
Oh, it will. Oh, you try. Hang on, John. Don't hang up.
Don't go anywhere, John.
Somebody carry me.
Yes, we're carrying you.
Be gentle.
Council meetings. This is what I was like, is it weird if you ask a question or how does that work?